This is Audible.
The Zombie Chapters, Volume 2, by Daniel Feit. Read by Ethan Sawyer. Copyright 2013 by Daniel Feit. Chapter 5. Brad Thomas, Helena, Montana. The most surreal thing about the last 40 minutes of Brad's flight, besides sitting next to a dead lady, was seeing the ground fires that dotted the Montana landscape below. Once the plane emerged beneath the storm clouds, Brad saw the vast destruction the meteorites had wrought on the countryside. Forest fires crawled up mountainsides. Houses, even entire towns, burned. Brad counted more than 11 large fires raging in the small city of Helena alone as his plane circled its airport, waiting for clearance to land. The first officer informed them that Homeland Security had directed all commercial airliners to land at the nearest airport large enough to accept them. When the pilot announced that he was waiting for the Helena Regional Airport to check the runway for damage and debris, two words came unbidden to Brad's mind: war zone. Despite his fear of flying and his discomfort at having a dead lady next to him, he wasn't so sure he wanted to land in the wreck of a town he observed below. Helena looked to be in utter chaos. Large sections of the city had lost power, and huge plumes of smoke blanketed several of the neighborhoods. It was obvious that many people had lost their lives in the city that night. Before the plane's wheels even touched down, the passengers triggered their cell phones in a mad rush to contact their loved ones. The plane was suddenly filled with the inappropriately joyful power-up tones of various cellular phone companies. As Brad waited for his smartphone to power on, he began to hear bitter expletives from several people around him. It was obvious that no one was getting through, and when Brad tried, he couldn't connect either. Once they finally landed, Brad found himself staring at the smoking carcass of a smashed Canada Regional jet. It was a United Airlines plane, from what Brad could still make out of the tail section. The aircraft had evidently been struck by a meteorite as it sat next to the airport's tiny terminal building. Its midsection was blown open, the starboard wing sheared off near the fuselage. He watched, transfixed, as a small army of ground personnel worked around the wreckage. Large sections of the aircraft's exterior were blackened by fire, and inky smoke seeped up into the sky from a dozen different places along its length. As they taxied past the CRJ, the pilot explained over the intercom that the stricken plane had thankfully been empty. His tone was somber, and even over the airliner's tinny speaker system, it was clear that he was fatigued. He parked the plane a long distance from the wreckage, and the passengers had to be ferried by bus to the terminal. An hour later, he was standing in the small terminal lounge, surrounded by crowds of stranded passengers. Most were still trying to reach loved ones on their phones. Some cried, and others stared into nothingness, but no one slept. Brad stared at the smoldering carnage of the CRJ through the huge windows of the terminal's second floor. An older guy in a reflective yellow safety vest barked orders to the men around him, though Brad couldn't hear anything through the thick glass. Watching the silent, unbelievable scene, Brad's thoughts kept returning to the 9/11 tragedy. He had been a consultant at that time, working at CPS, the city of San Antonio's power company. He could still remember standing in a large conference room, watching the Twin Towers burn on a flat-screen projector TV that received a raw video feed from one of the major news networks. He watched as people fell or jumped to their deaths. There was no voiceover on the video-only feed, no sound at all, just mute people falling to silent deaths. For weeks afterward, he had nightmares in which he was trapped, or running, or drowning, and no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't utter a sound. He could still visualize the smoke as it poured out of those buildings. There had been so much smoke. Now, as he watched the city in the distance, some of the buildings in Helena were burning that way, silently dying. Brad wondered if they, too, would collapse. He vividly recalled the thought that pervaded his mind as he watched the towers fall. The world just changed. Now, standing in the crowded waiting area, the same thought echoed through his head, but this time it was his world. The glass before him was a window, not a TV screen, and the images he saw through it weren't in HD. They were here and now. My world just changed, and it isn't going to change back anytime soon. Brad jumped when the airline captain suddenly spoke from directly behind him.
Hey, guy, you okay?
Brad caught the captain's visage reflected in the glass before he turned around. He was slightly older than Brad, maybe 45. His navy blue tie was hanging limply over a disheveled white shirt. He had the classic comb-over hairstyle of an ex-Air Force pilot turned airline career man. Brad's imaginative mind quickly crafted an image of the guy grinning maniacally as he triggered a bombload of napalm all over some jungle hillside in Vietnam. He turned around and extended his hand.
Hi. Oh, hey. That was some good flying back there.
Brad immediately grimaced at his cliché greeting, though the pilot didn't seem to notice. The captain shook his hand and smiled. His grip was firm, despite his beleaguered appearance.
Figured I'd get the heck out of Dodge the fastest way I know how. Even I was surprised how much that little bird has in her. Huh. We topped 800 miles per hour, and if I'd started off with more altitude, I bet I could have pushed her way past Mach 1.
Yep, definitely ex-Air Force. Brad nodded, his smile fixed as he remembered the terrifying dive. I think if we dove any faster, the passengers would have floated to the back of the plane and piled up in front of the restroom door. The pilot chuckled, clearly oblivious to Brad's discomfort at the memory.
Yeah, maybe.
His smile faded.
So, you were the guy next to Imelda Wharton?
Brad cocked his head.
Imelda who? Oh, the lady who passed away.
The captain said it quietly, but several of the stranded travelers around them turned to watch their conversation.
Oh, yeah, she grabbed my arm, then, after it was all over...
The man held up his hand.
Yeah, no, don't worry about it. I'm not trying to interrogate you. I just wanted to come over and thank you. I heard that you handled it really well. Most people would have really wigged out.
Brad smiled faintly at the compliment. The minutes after realizing that the lady was dead were a blur. He remembered hitting the call button and the first officer coming over. He told the officer to check the lady next to him and watched as the man checked for a pulse, swore quietly, and whispered,
"Let's not make this too public, okay, buddy?"
Brad nodded numbly and, for the remainder of the flight, refused to look in her direction. I didn't have much choice in the matter. There was nowhere else to sit. He hooked his thumb over his shoulder in the general direction of the airliner they had arrived on.
"Well, thanks all the same."
The pilot clapped Brad on the shoulder. The guy was much taller than he was, at least 6'2" compared to Brad's 5'6" frame.
"I'm Brad Thomas," he said,
and he nervously extended his hand again. The pilot took his hand once more.
"John Harris."
Brad nodded and glanced around at the crowd.
"I guess we're stranded here until they figure everything out."
It was already close to midnight. The captain didn't answer, but motioned somewhat conspiratorially for Brad to follow him out of the lounge area. When they were away from the crowd, he whispered,
"Some of the ground pounders, the guys on the ground crew, are heading home. One of them offered to take me and the rest of the flight crew to a hotel downtown. How about you join us?"
Brad smiled, relieved at the thought of getting out of the claustrophobic airport.
"Oh, man, I'd appreciate that."
20 minutes later, they were piled into Gene, the baggage handler's old Chevy 1500. It was a two-door, so Brad and John volunteered to ride in the bed with the luggage, while the flight attendant, Gladys, and Mark Marichek, John's first officer, rode in the cab with Gene. By the Helena Airport, which lay outside of the town proper, things seemed almost normal. Brad and John exchanged backstories as they rode, both men trying not to think about how chilled they were in the back of the truck, exposed to the late October 40-degree air. Brad told John about his wife, Charlotte, and their teenage girls, who, being only a year apart, fought like rabid cats whenever and wherever possible. John told Brad that he was divorced, and that his only son, Jared, was a sophomore at a small college in Oklahoma City. Once they turned onto Last Chance Gulch, the oddly named road that bisected the once booming gold mining town, their discussion faded. Gene slowed, and then stopped, just before reaching the first major intersection leading into town. Brad and John propped themselves up in order to look over the cab. Across the street, they saw a trio of houses that had burned to the ground. Despite the late hour, 20 or so people were milling around the area, while a single exhausted-looking cop ran a streamer of yellow plastic tape that read, "Police line, do not cross," from a tree to a post topped with a mailbox, which was one of the only things still standing. Brad saw the numbers 11201 on the mailbox, but evidently 11201, along with 11203 and 11205 for that matter, no longer existed. 11201 was at least still smoldering, whereas 11203 was nothing more than a crater.
"One of those meteorites," Brad started to say.
"Yeah," John said quietly. Gene put the truck back into gear and detoured to the right. At the next left, he turned onto a street that led into a small subdivision, where the houses were all 1960s Americana, orderly front yards and one-car garages. Brad heard distant sirens in almost every direction now, and smelled an acidic chemical odor that reminded him of burning garbage. A couple more blocks passed by. Gene took another left, and as he turned, Brad caught a glimpse of four or five people sprinting in front of a nearby house. Just when he was about to ask John if he'd seen them too, he saw another small group of people walking quickly down the sidewalk as Gene drove by. The urgency of their movements quickened Brad's heartbeat. Just then Gene turned so sharply that Brad's head banged into the back of the cab.
"Holy shit,"
John murmured, looking past Brad up the street that Gene had just evacuated. The entire block was ablaze. A lone fire truck sat in the middle of the street, fire hoses played out in every direction like disemboweled entrails from a gigantic red whale. Firemen and residents, some still in pajamas, ran all over the place, shouting to one another frantically. Brad saw a fire hose lying on the ground, spewing water out against a curb, while another was manned solely by three teenagers in sweatpants and sneakers. The teens were spraying water all over a nearby house, but Brad seriously doubted if they were accomplishing anything.
"Jeez, it's chaos."
Brad didn't realize he said it out loud until John muttered his agreement.
"Must not be enough fire units to go around," John said.
Brad could easily see the truth in that. Several homeowners tried to spray adjacent houses with garden hoses, while others tended to injured men and women. Brad even saw a bucket brigade trying to douse a blaze that was raging out of control in a single-story brick home. They formed a line from a nearby house and were passing pots, serving bowls, and pitchers of water up and down the line. It was like something off of Little House on the Prairie. Brad remembered seeing a couple of shows where Laura, or whoever, set a barn on fire, and all the citizens of Walnut Grove came to the rescue with their pots and buckets, only to be thwarted by the flames. There was no reason to believe that the same technique would work any better here in Helena.
"There goes your whole crop, Charles."
A few moments later, the scene was lost behind them as Gene accelerated down the side street. It occurred to Brad that Gene may have loved ones that he was worried about. Did Gene live nearby? Brad hoped not, but in light of everything that had transpired that evening, he realized the baggage handler was truly doing them a huge favor. Brad looked over at John and shook his head.
"My wife's not going to believe this. No friggin' way."
John looked over at him gravely.
"What?"
Brad asked. There was definitely something he didn't like about the way he was looking at him.
"Well, before we landed, the controller told us that all the passenger liners were being ordered to land," John said.
"Yeah, you told us that,"
Brad said, confused and growing increasingly alarmed. John shook his head.
"No. ATC said Homeland Security was grounding everyone. Nationwide."
"Nationwide for what?" Brad asked.
"This meteor thing, it wasn't..."
John nodded.
"It must have hit most of the nation."
Goosebumps erupted down Brad's arms as the revelation sunk in.
If the meteor storm struck everywhere else, "I've got to get home,"
Brad said, his voice barely above a whisper. He reached for his phone and tapped it open. No service.
"God damn it!"
He felt tight-chested anxiety welling in him as he thought of his family.
"I know the feeling, guy. One step at a time, though. Let's get past tonight and then figure out how to get back home. Homeland Security should have everything straightened out by tomorrow or the next day, and they'll let us resume our flights. There are going to be a lot of people wanting to get home to their families over the next few days, but I'll make sure you're on the first flight out of here, John said.
Brad nodded shakily, his mind still stunned by the implications of a meteorite storm large enough to strike the entire country. 5 minutes later, Gene stopped abruptly in front of a downtown hotel. It was a 7-story building with an illuminated sign that read, "Comfort Stay In, Helena." Brad and John jumped down and unloaded the bags, while Marichek and Gladys got out and walked around. Gene lowered his window long enough to say, "Good luck," before he threw the truck into gear and sped off. Brad and the flight crew turned to watch him before heading inside the double glass doors of the hotel. Brad glanced at Gladys as they walked, and her face looked even worse than it had looked on the plane. Huge black and blue bruises covered a good 50% of her face, and her upper lip was split and swollen. Her nose was bandaged up, and her right eye was nearly swollen shut.
"You okay?"
Brad asked. She nodded.
"Mostly, but I think my nose is broken."
Brad hadn't thought about it, but looking at her now, he was sure she was correct.
"You need to go to the hospital, then."
She gave him a skeptical look.
"You really think the hospital's going to have time to mess with some bumps and bruises and a broken nose? Where were you during the ride over here?"
He was startled at her sudden rudeness, but thought she did have a point.
"Yeah, I guess they're swamped."
"You think?"
she said, pushing through the glass door to the hotel. Brad and the flight crew walked up to the front desk.
"Hello?" Marichek called out. "Anybody home?"
A moment later, a nervous front desk clerk came out from the office. He looked about 19 years old, and his tan name badge read, "Trent." The kid was obviously shaken, and Brad heard the chatter of a news reporter emanating from the back room.
"The news?"
It was everything Brad could do to restrain himself from running around the counter to see what they were showing. John went first to pay for a room, but when he presented his American Express card, the kid said that the credit card machines were down. When John told him that the card was all he had, the kid pulled out an old credit card paper receipt machine and a stack of blank receipts. He put John's card on the machine, along with a paper receipt, and ran the imprinter bar over it. His hands shook as he handed John his card and driver's license, and then said quietly,
The phones are out, as far as I can tell.
Cable don't work either, except a couple of the local channels that I guess found a way to broadcast.
He paused.
There were explosions everywhere.
The kid looked over at Gladys, but when she returned his gaze, he diverted his eyes, embarrassed. He looked back to John.
"You guys just fly in on a plane?"
John nodded, and Trent shuddered.
You flew through that stuff?"
Brad chimed in.
"Yeah, it was not pleasant." "Wow."
Understanding dawned on Trent's face as his eyes flashed back over to Gladys's wrecked face. The kid was pensive for a moment, and then handed John a key card.
"Well, I'm sorry for the inconvenience. We'll get the phones and cable TV working again as soon as I can get someone to come on out."
It sounded like the kid felt personally responsible for the hotel's services being knocked out. Brad felt like using his best redneck survivalist crazy-ass old man voice and asking,
"You call this a hotel, and you can't even withstand an apocalyptic meteor strike? What's wrong with you youngsters? I'll bet this place ain't even demon-proof neither."
The kid was efficient, though. Brad gave him that. He checked the 4 guests in quickly, and as they headed for the elevators, Brad spied a pair of coffee carafes and a platter of muffins in the lobby.
"Hold up, I could really use some coffee," he said.
John, Marichek, and Gladys muttered their agreement, and soon they held vaguely warm cups of coffee and stale apple muffins in their hands, which they balanced carefully as they maneuvered their rollerboard luggage toward the elevator. Trent put John and Brad on the 6th floor. Gladys was on the 5th, and Marichek was on the 4th. As Gladys got off the elevator, John called after her.
"Hey, Glad, if you need anything, I'm in 606.
She nodded without turning back. On the 6th floor, John and Brad exited the elevator and started down the hallway. The building was obviously constructed on a narrow lot, because each floor consisted of only one short hallway that ran between 20 or so rooms.
"Hey, how about I throw my stuff down and come over for a bit?"
John asked. It was late, but Brad knew he wasn't going to sleep anytime soon, and the thought of being alone was not appealing. He guessed that John felt the same way.
"Yeah, that would be great. Come on over,"
Brad answered, and headed for the door marked 613. Brad slid his keycard into the door lock, saw the light turn green, and opened the door. It was a standard room. A queen-sized bed, a desk, a dresser with a flat-screen TV, a nightstand, all fairly new and in good shape. Brad dumped his laptop bag and black luggage onto the orange and brown comforter.
What is it with hotels and butt-ugly comforters?
He immediately went to the TV and turned it on. Cycling through the channels, he finally found one that was broadcasting. A frazzled-looking female reporter stood in front of a blazing warehouse building.
"The building behind me is still alight, as you can see, Jerry. Helena FD has informed me that they are prioritizing the residential areas of the city first. The tally of contained fires has reached 7. When last we spoke, Chief Hudson informed me that his department is aware of at least 9 more blazes, including the one behind me."
As she finished her sentence, a large beam and several sheets of metal fell off the warehouse's exterior wall onto a white cargo van. The timing couldn't have been better. The reporter was wide-eyed when she turned back toward the camera.
"Oh my goodness, Jerry, as you can see, part of the building has just collapsed onto one of the Prima Millworks vehicles,"
she said excitedly.
"We've not been able to reach any Prima officials, and at this time it is unclear whether they even know that their facility is burning."
"Really?" Brad thought, already annoyed. "This is why I don't watch the news. They want bad things to happen."
There was a knock at the door, and Brad went to let John in. The pilot had ditched his tie, but still held half a muffin in his coffee.
"The news is on. I guess there are still a ton of fires here," Brad said. "The local fire department hasn't gotten to half of them yet. Guess they don't have much firefighting capacity in such a small town."
John nodded, took another bite of his muffin, and moved over near the bed to watch the news. The image changed to a side-by-side view, with the anchor on the left and the reporter on the right. Beneath the anchor, the screen read, "Anchorman Jerry Hashley."
"Shelley, our last report from Mercy Memorial is that over 300 injuries have been suffered tonight," Jerry said, "and that the hospital is aware of at least 57 fatalities. Do you think these numbers will rise as the situation becomes clearer throughout the night?"
"Wow. I guess there were no openings at NASA, so Jerry had to put away his rocket science degree and take the news anchor job. What a stupid freaking question,"
Brad said, his annoyance and frustration growing by the second.
"Damn it, why weren't they giving any information about the rest of the country?"
If Shelley thought it was a stupid question, she didn't act like it. She enthusiastically replied,
"Jerry, from what I've seen so far, I can only guess that these figures are bound to rise. I've seen cars and entire buildings pulverized by meteorites. I've also heard unconfirmed reports that an airplane was struck at the airport and that there was a fire there. What we don't know is how anyone else is faring. We heard preliminary reports that this phenomenon was not localized, but we have yet to confirm that information. What I can tell our viewers is that we have not been able to reach any of our affiliated stations or the network hub that we usually work with for national stories. That suggests that the meteorite strike was not localized."
Brad muted the TV and tossed the remote down on the bed.
"Jeez, this is unreal."
John nodded. "You're not kidding. Know what I keep coming back to? Why the hell didn't anyone warn us? The biggest meteorite storm in probably millions of years, and none of the observatories saw it coming?"
"I hadn't thought of that. Damn, how could they have missed this?"
Brad went to the patio door and opened it. Maybe it was some sort of subconscious need to see what was going on around him, but he ignored the cold air and stepped out onto the narrow patio. Peering down, he saw that his room overlooked a portion of the parking lot, as well as several other shorter office buildings. Small, dark alleyways ran between and behind the buildings. John stepped out onto the patio next to Brad and took a sip of his coffee. The man looked calm, despite what they were going through. Brad was suddenly really glad that he was around, and made a mental note to get John's phone number before they parted ways in the morning, or whenever the powers that be allowed planes to fly again.
"Know what else I was thinking about?"
John asked.
"Chicago. Big cities like that must have taken so many hits."
John's tone was solemn, and he stared over the rooftops toward an orange glow near the edge of town. Half of the city was covered in a thick mat of pallid smoke that seemed to cling to the trees and buildings like a death shroud. Emergency sirens blared in the distance, and Brad could hear distant shouts echoing off the buildings below him. Brad turned to look at John.
He guessed, by the pilot's tone, that Chicago held some significance. It must be bad there. But they also have a lot more cops and fire stations.
John shrugged.
Did you ever read Cell by Stephen King?
No, I like Stephen King, but I never have time for reading.
At the beginning of the book, the main characters are trying to escape some big city, I think it was Philly, and one of the guys asks if modern cities can burn, you know, like the way San Francisco burned back in the day.
Yeah, and did it?
John asked. A part of it did, I guess. The characters moved on pretty quickly, so it didn't give a lot of details. Anyway, I don't think modern cities can burn. Do you?
John looked pensive as he looked out over downtown Helena.
It was late, but the streets looked unnaturally abandoned, like everyone was cowering inside, waiting for the nightmare to be over.
I think parts of it can. I can't see downtown Chicago burning. It's all steel and concrete, he finally said.
Brad started to say, but then saw four men run up an alleyway and disappear around a corner. From the frown on John's face, it was clear that he had seen them too. What the hell?
I don't think I want to know what those guys are up to, John said.
They heard the tinkle of breaking glass.
Looters? You gotta be kidding me, Brad said. This is unreal.
He walked back into his room and picked up the phone.
Still dead.
Great. John came into the room as Brad went to the thermostat and turned up the heat. When he turned around, he saw John staring at the muted TV. Brad walked over to the bed so that he could see what John was watching. It took a moment for him to figure out what he was looking at. The image was turned sideways. The left half of the screen was wet asphalt that led straight up to the camera. The road led away from the camera toward the right side of the screen, where the image displayed the bottom half of an ambulance. The back door was open, and its red flashers were on, bathing the scene in an intermittent, dull red glow. A gurney lay upended on the pavement next to the gaping door. Brad realized that the camera was lying unattended on its side in a street, and that, for some reason, the station was still transmitting the feed. As he watched, he saw someone run past the camera. Brad could only see the person from the knees down. Dark pants and white tennis shoes that were blurred by the quick motion. Seconds later, two more people ran past, one wearing pants but no shoes, the other wearing one slipper and a pink bathrobe that billowed behind her as she sprinted between the camera and the ambulance. Brad. The whispered word made Brad start. He peeled his eyes from the scene on the TV to look at John.
Turn the sound on,
John ordered. He locked eyes with Brad for a moment before turning slowly back to the screen. Brad reached to the end of the bed and grabbed the remote with shaking hands. He stared at it for a moment, not sure if he really wanted to hear the audio of what they saw in the frozen camera. He forced himself to push the mute button. The scream that erupted from the TV startled Brad so badly that he fumbled and dropped the remote. He took several involuntary steps back from the screen, shocked by the unrestrained terror in the woman's voice. Diving for the remote, Brad scooped it up and groped for the volume controls as the woman continued screaming and shouting unintelligibly each time she took a breath. John yelled something that he didn't catch, and just as Brad turned toward him, he heard the first gunshot. The TV's volume was set so high that the sound blasted off the room's walls. Both men actually ducked as the screen flashed white. Three more shots rang out, and Brad suddenly found himself kneeling on the floor next to the bed as he stared, transfixed, at the image on the TV. A man's hand, palm up on the pavement, now filled most of the screen. Brad saw a silver wedding band. A rivulet of blood seeped from under the man's cuff to pool in his palm before trickling onto the asphalt. The hand jerked, and then lay still. Each time the ambulance's lights flashed, the wedding band turned amber, the blood emerald black. The image was replaced by a circular pattern on a white background. Large capital letters sprawled across the screen. Please stand by. Chapter 6. Officer Jesse Benavides. Shots fired.
52 confirmed injuries, 14 confirmed deceased, including Officer Polson.
Jesse glanced down toward his uniform at the mention of Ray's name.
Gobs of hardened mud clung to his boots, and there were long splotches on his dark trousers that resembled ketchup stains. But it's not ketchup. He could feel it against his skin, wet and sickeningly sticky. The city secretary continued,
"At least 10 residential fires that we know of. Wilshire VFD has responded to all of them and has performed an initial evaluation. 2 of the 10 have been fully contained."
"What about those not contained? Is there any danger of them spreading to other properties?"
It was Councilman Mario Polk who interrupted. He was a small man with tiny, critical eyes and the forever perfect comb-over hairstyle of a professional politician. A professional politician in Sonrisa, Texas. Now that was a laugh. Sonrisa was small enough that Jesse knew most of its residents, and of those he knew, he liked Polk the least. The man was a cabrón, arrogant, hawkish, and cuttingly sarcastic during even the most mundane of conversations. Despite his diminutive stature, or perhaps because of it, Polk always expended a great deal of effort making his presence known. And because the man was an attorney, Jesse frequently ran into him at Sonrisa's courthouse. Polk liked to announce his impending arrival with the precise click-clack-click-clack staccato of his expensive Florsheim shoes on the building's austere, polished marble floor. This habit, in conjunction with his overall demeanor and his thin, closely cropped mustache, had years ago earned him the title of Little Hitler among the rest of Sonrisa's public officials. Unsurprisingly, Polk actually seemed to like the moniker. The radio set on the conference room table squawked to life as Wilshire County's volunteer fire department chief chimed in.
"We've checked them all, and we're keeping tabs on as many as we can. Yes, some will spread, and we've made attempts to evacuate the surrounding houses where there's an imminent threat. What we can't do right now is have men at each site, so we're depending on the police department to monitor those other blazes until we can get to them."
Polk turned to Jesse. The officer looked up from his uniform and spoke with a slight Latino accent.
"Councilman, as I mentioned before, most of our units aren't available right now. We sent Katie, our on-call dispatcher, to check on the fires downtown."
Jesse, who stood 6'4" and packed 230 pounds of solid, broad-shouldered muscle, was known for his soft-spoken disposition. Tonight, though, he was particularly reticent. He met the councilman's gaze briefly, and then looked back down at his boots as he leaned against the faux wood-paneled wall of Sonrisa City Hall's conference room. Jesse's dark brown eyes flicked to the radio as Chief Mills jumped in.
"That won't cut it, Mario. I know what you're thinking, but we just don't have the trucks to deal with all the blazes out there. 4th and Pecan alone drain 2 of our rigs, and they take at minimum 20 minutes each to refill before we can get them to the next site."
To say that Sonrisa's firefighting infrastructure was antiquated would be paying it an undue compliment. The city had spent a pittance over the last few years installing fire hydrants and piping in a couple of its larger neighborhoods, but there was much left undone, and the city still hadn't purchased any modern engines that could tap into the new hydrants. The VFD's rigs were old water tender trucks, one-shot wonders, as Mills called them.
"You get one shot," he once explained. "So you spray and pray, because if those 2,000 gallons don't cut it, you're driving all the way back to the station for a refill."
It was ridiculous, Jesse thought, but the truth was that Sonrisa was so ruralized that running water lines across the entire city was simply too impractical.
"Sergeant Benavidez, you guys sent Katie the dispatcher out, and that's it? You're shitting me, right?"
The councilman's tone was dripping with derision. Jesse shifted, locking gazes with the man, but Freddie Swenson, the city manager, spoke first.
"I doubt it's his fault, Mario. Calm down. Everyone's doing what they can."
If Polk was Little Hitler, then Freddie Swenson was a country-western version of Kris Kringle. He had at least 50 pounds on jolly old St. Nicholas, at least the ones Jesse had seen in the movies, but otherwise could have played the part without makeup or modification. Freddie had a classic bulbous nose, ever-twinkling eyes, and the high, chubby cheeks that Jesse imagined would easily redden into merry, round circles of holiday cheer if Sonrisa ever got cold enough. He even had the iconic beard. Naturally, Freddie always volunteered to play Santa during Sonrisa's annual Christmas on Main Street outdoor gala. The voluminous avalanche of gray and white hair that flowed down from his face and cascaded over his round stomach had, more times than anyone could count, been put to the test by incredulous children as they sat on his lap. Some of the pictures taken by Santa's red and green-clad helpers, depicting wonder-struck children caught in the act of tugging on Freddy's beard, had been featured in local and even national publications. They had been so heartwarming and genuine that they would have made Norman Rockwell break down and cry. Freddy's heart exceeded even the circumference of his waistline, and he loved every minute of it. In short, Freddy was about as unpulk as any mortal man could be. The councilman sat back in his chair and glared at Freddy before tossing his pen onto the beige conference table in front of him.
Wonderful.
Jesse responded flatly. Councilman, we've currently got 14 officers out there responding to a dispatcher's list over 3 pages long. There's been almost no word at all from the Wilshire County Sheriff's Office. They're just as busy as we are.
Also, no word from TxDOT. One of the biggest problems we're facing is the damage sustained to the roadways, Freddy said.
The Texas Department of Transportation, Jesse knew, normally would have been responsible for responding to road hazards.
I've had to post my own guys at some of the intersections, and we're still finding more and more roads that need to be blocked off. Those meteor things punched 6-foot-wide holes in more streets than I can count, and in this darkness, people are driving smack into them and getting hurt.
This is frickin' madness, Polk said.
Freddy ignored him and turned to Jesse.
Sergeant, I can give you my 4 water well maintenance guys and a couple of city utility trucks. They can get out to some of these fires and at least make sure no one's getting too close in the meantime. I'll send them out with portable radios so they can keep us posted.
Jesse nodded, and Mills chimed in over the radio.
Freddy, anything you can do would be appreciated.
Polk frowned, his thin lips contorting into a smirk. He seemed peeved at not having made the decision himself. He glanced from the city manager to Jesse, who met his gaze. This time, it was Polk who looked away. Jesse glanced at the wall clock. 3:43 a.m.
Power?
Polk barked the question.
Where is South Texas Electric? They know they are supposed to send a rep to the ERCC.
Jesse fought the urge to roll his eyes at the man's pouty tone. The Emergency Response Command Center had officially stood up about 3 hours earlier when Freddy came by, unlocked Sunrisa City Hall's front doors, and turned the lights on in the building's only conference room. Councilman Polk had shown up shortly afterward, immediately jumped on the radio, and had started demanding reports from anyone who would listen. By then, Jesse had spent nearly 3 hours responding to dispatch calls. The horror of each scene he responded to would have ranked tonight as one of the worst of his 12-year career, and he had seen a dozen such scenes, each more grisly than the last. Several of Sonrisa's businesses lay in ruins, and Jesse counted no less than 10 houses and trailer homes obliterated by direct impacts. So far, no one had the time to check for survivors. He had also seen 2 automobiles that had been impaled by meteorites. Both had been pole-vaulted into the air, ejecting their passengers in every direction. Amazingly, many motorists had tried to drive during the meteorite storm. Reports of multi-vehicle accidents started trickling in almost as soon as the strange meteorites began descending upon them. Once the roads started taking direct hits, vehicles drove into the debris, or into each other, and clogged all of the main thoroughfares leading into and out of Sonrisa and its satellite subdivisions. Smoke from unchecked brush fires and residential blazes blanketed the area, further impairing vision. Within half an hour, they'd lost one of the area's 4 ambulances to a rollover wreck, and lost a second about 40 minutes later when the driver swerved to avoid a dead horse, ran off the road, and ended up in a farmer's cattle tank. Jesse had picked up its soaking wet crew and was transporting them to Conrad Memorial, where he figured they could do the most good, when he received the call about Officer Polson. Jesse responded, thinking he was lucky to have 3 EMTs arrive at the scene with him. Ray had evidently pulled his cruiser off Interstate 97 and was trying to extract a victim from an upended SUV when another vehicle came around a curve, hit a patch of loose debris, and slammed into the SUV. Ray was ejected out of the stricken vehicle's passenger door and sustained massive head trauma in the process. He and Jesse had known each other since high school. They graduated from the same police academy class and had even dated each other's sisters. He was the godfather of Jesse's son Matthew and was one of the best men Jesse had ever known. The really amazing thing was that Ray was still conscious when Jesse arrived. The EMTs did what they could, working with grim faces and exchanging knowing looks as Jesse knelt next to his friend. It was over in a few minutes. Jesse's last words to Ray had been,
"You are one Billy badass. You know that, bro?"
Ray had looked up at him calmly and even managed to smile before closing his eyes. The hardest part of the ordeal was being forced to leave Ray's body lying beside his cruiser. Wilshire County didn't have a morgue, and none of the local funeral homes had responded to calls for assistance. Jesse had no choice but to cover the body and leave it there for later retrieval. It felt odd, almost unfinished, and it left Jesse feeling strange. He turned his vehicle around toward Sonrisa and stopped in the middle of the road to gaze at the blanket-draped body. The night was still, and yet his senses told him that something was amiss, that somehow Ray wasn't really gone. He threw his vehicle into park and was about to get out of his cruiser to check on Ray's body when his radio suddenly crackled to life. More emergency calls were coming in. With a resigned sigh, Jesse put his cruiser back into gear and sped away.
"So who is keeping minutes?"
Polk was saying.
"Minutes? You think this is a goddamned board meeting?" Freddy asked, incredulous.
Polk waved a hand at the rest of the room and spoke in a suddenly solemn tone. If one were cynical, and Jesse certainly was, nearly all police officers were, one would think Polk had practiced this little speech on the drive over.
"We need to document what we do here tonight. Document it very carefully. If history ever questions our decisions, the media..."
Freddy pushed himself up from his chair so violently that it bounced off the wall behind him and fell over. There was no jolly mirth in his round, chubby face now, and his eyes were bulging with barely restrained anger. Leaning over the conference room table, Freddy pointed a beefy finger at Polk and started shouting. The others in the room quickly joined in, and one of Freddy's assistants moved to restrain him. Polk pushed himself back from the conference table, fear evident on his face. He'd just made the permanent naughty list, Jesse thought, attempting to suppress a smile. Jesse watched the argument for a moment, then turned and walked out. He wasn't worried about the men coming to blows. Polk was too scared, and Freddy, angry as he might be, wasn't one to deck the halls or the arrogant politicians unless it was absolutely necessary. Jesse strode through the reception area and heard Polk shout,
"Where the hell do you think you're going?"
He didn't bother responding. A few more strides and he was out of the little city hall building. He headed across the parking lot while taking in Sonrisa's downtown area. Manicured lawns filled spaces between the administration buildings and the largest edifice in Sonrisa, the Wilshire County Courthouse. The 1920s-era gray stone courthouse was 5 stories tall, if one counted the gilded dome and diminutive Justitia, the Roman goddess of justice, perched on top of its green, steeply sloping metal roof. Jesse climbed into his Dodge Durango Special, which was one of only 2 that the department owned. They were reserved for shift supervisors and sported a supercharged 5.7-liter Hemi V8 engine, along with all-wheel drive. He loved the throaty growl it made as he cranked it over.
"Unit 17, 10-8,
he spoke into the transmitter on his left shoulder as he backed his vehicle.
"Unit 17, 10-4,
Marissa, the shift dispatcher, replied. Jesse knew everything he said was being overheard at the ERCC. He had used the police 10 code that indicated he was now in service, the same code he would have used upon returning from a lunch break or taking a shit at a gas station. The subtlety of his joke would be lost on the members of the ERCC, Polk in particular, although he was sure his fellow officers would get a kick out of it.
I'm done babysitting politicians. Now I'm back doing real work.
Jesse pulled out of the parking lot and turned his vehicle left. He wanted to check on Katie, who was stationed on the corner of 7th and B. Arriving a few minutes later, he saw that a large crowd had gathered and was watching impotently as two nearby houses burned. Fortunately, the structures were both on large lots, and although some patches of lawn had caught fire, the danger of the blazes spreading to adjacent houses seemed minimal. Most of the crowd looked on expectantly as Jesse conferred with Katie in the middle of the street. He realized his was probably the first uniform they had seen all night long. It made him feel guilty and almost embarrassed for not being able to assist them. He could at least give them some information, though. He walked over and addressed the group, which was about 30 strong.
Folks, I'm Officer Benavides. We've been in frequent contact with the VFD, and they're aware of these fires.
A murmur went through the crowd as they listened.
Firefighting units will arrive as soon as they can. They're addressing blazes at other locations right now that have a higher potential to spread.
That really set the crowd off. They exchanged worried looks and started talking excitedly amongst themselves. A bald man in a bathrobe spoke up and pointed at a house next to one of the flaming structures.
That's my house over there. I've lived there for over 30 years, he said.
His eyes were suddenly watery and he stopped talking.
Sir, I understand. Your home should be fine. We have at least 10 other fires in the area.
The whole town's gonna burn down,
he heard someone shout, and Jesse knew he'd made a mistake. The crowd suddenly looked like it was about to panic. He saw all of the classic signs he had been trained to watch for. Wild gestures, shouts, and sudden hysterical crying. An ear-splitting whistle caught him, as well as the surrounding citizens, completely off guard. He turned to see Katie lowering her hand from her mouth.
"Chill the hell out!" she shouted.
The crowd was so shocked at the short, middle-aged woman's command that they immediately quieted.
"No one said the fires were out of control. We're going to make it through this together as a town, but we need you guys to get a grip. Do what you can do to help us, and by tomorrow we'll be in much better shape."
Katie pointed to the bald man.
"Go get your garden hose and start spraying down the side of your house, and your roof too if you can reach it. That should prevent stray embers from igniting anything."
She then pointed to a group of 4 men.
"You guys, get some flashlights, go around back, and do the same for all the other houses that are adjacent to this one."
The men looked at each other, glanced back at Katie, and took off running to comply.
"Let's go!"
the bald guy shouted, and 2 women joined him from the crowd as he rushed back toward his house. Jesse turned to stare at Katie.
"That was unbelievable," he said.
She ignored the comment, strode past him, and continued barking orders. In less than 2 minutes, the crowd had dispersed with instructions to secure a tractor, flashlights, masks, first aid kits, portable fire extinguishers, and wet towels. She instructed each little group she formed to appoint runners that would report back every 20 minutes at her cruiser in the intersection, which she dubbed her command post. Speechless, Jesse left the scene grinning ear to ear with unabashed pride.
"On-call dispatcher my ass. The woman is a damn Joan of Arc."
An hour later, he had set up similar groups of deputized citizens at 4 other blazes. Each group was left with a handheld radio and a designated leader, whom he charged with reporting in every half hour, using a preset police frequency. He lacked Katie's elan, he realized, but it still worked. His training taught him to never task civilians with duties that could put them in harm's way, but he immediately saw the wisdom of her approach. If people were helping, even in small ways, they felt empowered, and that feeling of control worked to counteract the fear that can lead to panic. Besides, he mused, it was really refreshing to be able to rely on the community for a change. He was used to serving and protecting. That was his job. But it certainly was nice to see civilians pitching in.
"Unit 17?
17, copy,"
Jesse responded immediately.
17, we have a report of a 1016 in progress at 1433 Birch. Say again, 1433 Birch.
"A domestic disturbance? Who the hell takes a swing at their wife on a night like this?" "Copy, 1016. My ETA is at least 10 minutes. Send 1060 for now,"
Jesse responded. His brow knit with concern as he hit the brakes and threw his Durango Special into a tire-shrieking U-turn. He wanted to get boots on the ground ASAP, so he ordered the dispatcher to send the closest officer, also known as the 1060, first. Jesse wasn't sure why, but the call had that feel to it, the odd, indescribable feeling that all law enforcement officers can relate to, an eerie sixth sense tugging that something was about to go horribly wrong. This call wouldn't be routine. He was certain of it.
Dispatch, this is Unit 7. I am 1060, en route.
It was Officer Raf Martinez, the shift's K-9 unit, and that was good. At least he wouldn't be alone. His partner, Sasha, was one of the most intelligent German shepherds that Jesse had ever seen, and she was loyal to Officer Martinez to the death. He was still a very junior officer, having been with the department for only 18 months, but Sasha would take good care of him. She always did.
Copy, Unit 7, dispatch said.
Watch yourself, 7,
Jesse added. He punched the accelerator and heard the Hemi roar to life as he rocketed down Highway 181 back toward Sonrisa.
Copy that, boss,
Martinez replied. 3 minutes later, Martinez radioed that he was on scene. 2 minutes after that, he reported no answer at the residence and no signs of a struggle. Jesse's Durango topped 90 miles per hour as he weaved from lane to lane, avoiding debris in the roadway. He dared not go faster, and yet, listening to Martinez's updates, he knew something was wrong. His stomach knotted as he raced toward Birch Street, on the far outskirts of Sonrisa, as fast as he could. A minute later, Martinez radioed a third time.
Unit 7, Sasha's got something.
Jesse could hear her barking in the background before Martinez keyed off his radio. She sounded agitated, aggressive.
Shit!
Copy 7,
the dispatcher replied. Another minute passed while Jesse waited for Martinez to elaborate. When he didn't, Jesse radioed him.
7, what is your 20?
He asked, asking Martinez to report his location. The seconds ticked by as he waited anxiously. Martinez finally answered, sounding winded. Jesse could hear Sasha barking incessantly in the background, punctuated occasionally with a deep, throaty, don't fuck with me growl.
Sasha's on to something. My 20 is...
He was breathing rapidly, obviously running as he spoke.
I'm in a patch of woods, about 30 yards behind the house.
Martinez paused again, probably to catch his breath.
I saw blood on the back fence. Shit, I knew it.
Jesse wanted to pounce on the gas pedal, but driving even faster would only further increase the risk that he'd get into an accident.
Copy 7. Use caution. I'm still about 8 minutes out,
Jesse replied.
Unit 7, are you requesting additional backup?
Dispatch asked. Again, Martinez took a long time to respond.
This is 7. Someone's out here.
His voice was quiet now, although Sasha was still barking loudly. Jesse wasn't sure if Martinez was spooked or just out of breath.
10-4, Unit 7,
the dispatcher said. She had obviously heard enough and made the decision herself.
All units, I need backup to 1433 Birch Street. Say again, 1433 Birch.
Unit 2, I am ETA 15 minutes.
Another officer responded immediately.
This is Unit 11. I'm heading that way. ETA about 20 minutes.
Another said. Jesse was clearly the 1060, but he didn't call off the other officers. He didn't like the radio traffic he was getting from Martinez. A few moments later, Martinez keyed his transmitter again. He must have toggled it from push to transmit, because his audio feed was now constant. It was standard practice when the department's officers moved into a hostile situation. Dispatch and other units could listen without the on-site officer having to take time to toggle anything. It also left the officer with both hands free to do whatever needed to be done.
Hold your hands where I can see them,
he shouted.
Stand still. Put your hands up or I will release my dog.
A moment later, he added,
Sir, you need to stay where you are. We're going to get an ambulance here for you. Dispatch, this is 7. This man's been injured pretty badly. I can see multiple lacerations to his face and upper torso. I'm going to need ambulance here ASAP.
Unit 7, 10-4. I'll get EMT out there as soon as possible,
the dispatcher replied.
Sir, you need to stay where you are,
Martinez repeated.
Sir, back off or I will release my dog.
Legally, he needed to warn the guy at least 3 times in order to cover his ass, Jesse knew. He wondered what the hell this supposedly injured guy was doing to make Martinez feel threatened. Martinez repeated his warning two more times and then shouted,
"Hold him, Sasha!"
Jesse turned off Highway 181 onto Twin Oak Street, the Durango's tires squealing loudly. Jesse could hear the timbre of Sasha's barking change to a bloodthirsty snarl.
He should have listened.
Whoever it was that Sasha was about to restrain was in for a supremely bad experience. She was trained to stop short of breaking the skin of an assailant, but her attack was notoriously fierce. She had once dislocated a man's arm as she chomped down on it and shook it side to side as violently as her powerful neck muscles would allow. The guy later tried to sue the department for the use of excessive force. This dog was a pro. You did not want to mess with Sasha. A moment later, though, Jesse heard the dog yelp in pain.
"No!" Martinez shouted. "Stay where you are, asshole!"
Jesse heard some thumps, like footsteps.
Crack!
Silence. A grunt.
Crack!
Even louder.
Martinez's baton?
Martinez grunted, as if from an impact. Jesse heard a strange, low moan that reminded him of wind sighing through the cracks in a dusty, deserted cottage.
Shit, shit, shit!
Jesse dodged around a parked car, then threw his vehicle into a sliding right turn onto the 6,000 block of Birch. He was perhaps 5 blocks away from the scene now.
Hold on, damn it, hold on!
There was no doubt in his mind that he was hearing a struggle on the other end of the radio. It sounded like someone was sliding a crumpled piece of paper across Martinez's transmitter, and Jesse realized that he must be on the ground. A sharp inhale. A grunt.
Bang!
The sound of the gunshot made Jesse jump as it reverberated inside his vehicle.
Bang! Shots fired! Shots fired!
The dispatcher practically screamed.
Unit 7, please respond. What is your status?
Shit, talk to us, Raph.
There were more muffled scraping sounds, and then Sasha was barking again. It quickly turned into a bloodlust-fueled snarl. There was a fleshy, rending sound that turned Jesse's stomach, and he realized that Sasha wasn't restraining now. She was defending her partner.
Go, Sasha! Good girl!
The scraping sound stopped.
Officer down.
Martinez wheezed.
Down. Where are you guys?
The words were wet, weak, pleading. Sasha yelped in pain once more, and then yelped even louder, over and over again.
Leave her alone,
Martinez said. His voice was defiant, but his words came slowly, with a lethargy that made Jesse grimace.
Bang! Bang!
2 more shots rang out, and Jesse could now hear them both over his radio and outside his vehicle.
What the hell? You,
he heard Martinez say. His words were almost indiscernible now. 2 seconds later, and Jesse was hitting the brakes so hard that his Durango slid 10 feet and nearly clipped Martinez's cruiser. He had already unlocked his shotgun, an SLP MK1 with a 6-round Mesa tactical side saddle, from the center console, and was out the door before the vehicle even rocked back from its sudden stop.
Unit 17, I am 1023,
Jesse shouted into his transmitter. He was sprinting across the front lawn, loading the shotgun and heading to the far side of the 2-story home where he could access the backyard.
Unit 17, copy on the scene,
the dispatcher replied. He could hear the strain in her voice. She tried reaching Martinez again. No reply. She hailed the 2 other officers that were en route and requested an updated ETA. They were still over 10 minutes out. It couldn't be helped. Jesse wasn't about to wait for them, not with an officer downed. While running, Jesse transferred the shotgun to his left hand, planted his right hand on a fence post, and vaulted the short wooden fence. He remembered Martinez saying that he was in some woods about 30 yards behind the house. Sure enough, the house backed to a large patch of mature mesquites. What Martinez hadn't mentioned, however, was that the woods were almost totally concealed by a low blanket of wispy gray smoke. The moonless night was still dark, and the smoke acted like a layer of thick fog, clinging closely to the ground in the humid air. There was also an odd iridescence to the woods, a faint greenish glow similar to the fiery meteorites that had trashed the town earlier. The copse in front of him rose slowly as it climbed a low hill, and the glow appeared to emanate from beyond the rise, backlighting the foggy smoke. Nearby trees, already blurred in the soupy air, took on the appearance of misshapen sentinels. They were utterly motionless, gray, hostile, giant statuary from some ancient past, teleported here and corrupted, brought alive to stand guard. The whole scene was so surreal, so unexpectedly macabre, that it made Jesse stop in his tracks. He was breathing faster now, and he knew it wasn't solely from the short sprint around the house. Something was wrong here. He listened, trying to detect a sound that would guide him. Nothing seemed to move. There were no noises at all. No animals, no wind, not even the leaves dared make a sound. Jesse found it hard to believe that Martinez had the cojones to walk into the woods in the first place. He moved forward slowly, trying not to make any noise. After a few strides, he reached over and grabbed his flashlight. Holding it with his free hand, he toggled the safety on his shotgun and cradled the weapon in his right arm.
"Officer Martinez?"
he called out. Jesse shouted the words, but they came back hollow, muted.
"Raph!"
he added. There was no response. He lowered his voice and spoke into his shoulder unit.
"Unit 17, I'm heading further into the woods. Be advised, visibility is very poor. Copy 17,
the dispatcher said. He could hear the tension in her voice. Jesse advanced cautiously, glancing all around, keeping both his light and the barrel of his SLP pointed in the direction that he was looking. The smoke draping the air absorbed most of the flashlight's illumination. A sound behind him caused Jesse to spin around. It had been small, nothing more than a dull, distant thud, but in the utter silence enveloping him, it sounded foreign and out of place.
"Martinez?"
Jesse called out, quieter this time. Maybe he'd already gone too far into the woods. He was still moving uphill, but in the thick smoke there was no way to gauge how far he'd gone. Another soft, earthy thud, this one closer, sounded to his right. Jesse spun to face that direction, but saw nothing. Large trees gazed down at him from three sides, so he moved to his left, trying to navigate around them to follow the source of the sound.
"Unit 17, what is your 20?
The dispatcher's voice was so loud and unexpected that Jesse nearly jumped.
"Unit 17, I'm not sure exactly. I'm in the woods somewhere. Unable to locate Officer Martinez so far."
"Copy that. Be careful, 17.
"No shit."
Jesse toggled his transmitter so that it was always on, just as Martinez had done. He moved around a large mesquite, ducking under a couple thorn-covered branches, and was just straightening up when he heard a low whimper.
"Sasha!"
Jesse took a couple tentative strides and stopped again to listen. He heard her again, a barely audible whine off to his right. Moving quickly, he ducked under a few more branches as he circled back to the right. He nearly tripped over the German Shepherd before he saw her.
"Sasha!"
Jesse said.
"Hey, chula!"
He dropped to one knee, glanced around to make sure no one was nearby, and then examined her. She had several deep gashes on her side, and a few tufts of fur were missing around her neck. He stroked her head, and Sasha emitted a low, weak growl before returning to her whimpering.
"Shh, it's okay,"
Jesse said, stroking her head once more. He bent to get a closer look at her wounds and frowned. It looked as though she had gotten into a fight with another animal. He saw what looked like claw marks and even what appeared to be a bite mark on her right haunch. Martinez hadn't mentioned another dog, though.
Slap!
Something heavy and wet hit the ground nearby, beyond where Sasha lay. Jesse immediately jerked upright and raised his SLP.
"Sonrisa Police!"
Jesse shouted. No reply. Jesse stepped around Sasha and moved a few paces toward the sound. He could hear something. The sound resembled a gurgling creak, but more irregular. It started, stopped, and started again.
"Oh, hell with it."
Jesse strode forward, rounding a big oak tree, shotgun leveled. A mere 5 feet in front of him, Jesse caught the dark blue of Martinez's uniform in the light of his flashlight. He adjusted the light to get a better look.
"Oh my God,"
he moaned, unaware that he had said it aloud. Martinez's eyes were looking toward him, or they would have been if he were alive. Most of his throat and neck were gone, and the man leaning over him had a piece of dark flesh hanging from his mouth. The man turned at the sound of Jesse's exclamation, and he saw a momentary flash of greenish light in the assailant's eyes.
For a mad instant, Jesse thought he must be looking at some large, deformed animal.
A raccoon's eyes shine like that at night.
The man was hunched over Martinez like a predator crouching over its kill. His left hand clutched the center of Martinez's shirt, wadding it into a ball inside his big fist. His legs were pulled underneath him, with one knee resting on the dead officer's stomach. The man stared at him, unmoving.
"Stand up! Hands in the air!"
Jesse shouted through clenched teeth. His body felt stiff with tension. He felt the familiar, danger-fueled adrenaline rush kicking in as nervous excitement coursed through his limbs. The man rose slowly, his eyes staring not at Jesse's face, but somewhere between his neck and waist. He was big, Jesse saw, at least 250 pounds, although most of it was flab. Jesse's well-trained eyes immediately catalogued what he was seeing. Black hair, brown eyes, multiple lacerations on his face, red flannel shirt, blue jeans, brown boots, large tattoo on his right forearm. As the man faced him, Jesse saw dark circular blotches on his chest and midsection. Gunshot wounds. Martinez had tagged him at least 4 times.
Kevlar? Was this asshole wearing Kevlar?
Hands up!
Jesse took a step back, putting a little more distance between himself and the madman. The guy continued to stare at Jesse's chest, his head canted strangely to the right. Jesse was breathing even faster now, unnerved by the attacker's odd gaze. Most of the lower half of the man's face was covered in blood, probably Martinez's.
What the hell was going on?
Jesse was beginning to wonder what he'd do next when the man lurched forward. He stepped over Martinez's body and strode straight at Jesse, who instinctively backed up a few paces.
Stop or I will shoot!
Some distant part of Jesse's mind was telling him that the suspect wasn't armed, and that using deadly force might later be questioned.
Stop! I will shoot!
He shouted at the man. He made no indication that he even heard the warning. The guy kept walking forward, his movements oddly uncoordinated, his gaze still fixed on Jesse's chest. Jesse tried to step quickly backward again. His left foot moved, but stopped short against a rock or tree root, and suddenly he was stumbling. His left arm flew out to the side automatically as he windmilled, trying to regain his balance. His flashlight went flying, hit the ground a few yards away, and shut off. The attacker lurched forward, his arms outstretched. Only then did the man make a sound. A low, grieved moan emanated from him, and Jesse's eyes widened in recognition. He had heard it before, over Martinez's radio. In person, however, it was chilling, a despairing, rattling vocalization, like a dying man's final exhalation. Jesse's head banged against a tree limb, and he fell to his knees. The man was now only a few feet away, his fingers barely out of range of his shotgun's barrel. Jesse aimed for his chest and pulled the trigger. The blast was deafening. Already off balance, Jesse was launched further backward and landed hard on the ground. Simultaneously, a high-pitched shriek, unlike anything Jesse had ever heard before, erupted from the suspect. The man was backpedaling toward Martinez's body, his arms flailing out to either side. Amazingly, he somehow kept his balance. His flannel shirt hung in ribbons on his chest, only barely covering the torn, ragged flesh beneath. Even in the darkness, Jesse could see the massive damage his shot had inflicted on the man's chest.
Shots fired! Shots fired!
His transmitter was still on, and the dispatcher was shouting over the radio. Jesse's mind felt numb. He shook his head, realized that the suspect was still standing, and at the same moment realized that he was not holding his gun. Jesse rolled onto his right side and propped himself up as he frantically scanned the ground for his shotgun. It lay a few feet away, and he dove for it. Scooping it up, he glanced back toward his assailant. The man had turned away, still shrieking an otherworldly howl, and was stumbling off into the smoky darkness. Jesse sat up quickly, leveled his gun at the man, and shouted,
"Stop right there!"
The man, a mere 15 feet away, was already almost completely obscured by the wafting smoke. He again ignored Jesse's command.
"Damn it!"
Jesse scrambled to his feet and ran to retrieve his flashlight. His right hand and lower arm were numb, so he switched his weapon to his left.
He could still hear the suspect's mad shrieking. He won't make it far with wounds like that. Rather than give chase, Jesse quickly located his flashlight and returned to Martinez's body. Getting a better look at the scene, he had to fight the urge to gag. Martinez's throat, as well as the fleshy part of his left cheek, had been torn open. Large chunks were missing from the wounds.
The guy had been eating him. He was honest to God eating him, like some sort of damn cannibal.
There was blood everywhere. Dark pools of it surrounded the body. Martinez's eyes stared up at him blankly, and to Jesse's mind, the rookie officer's eyes were filled with accusation.
What took you so long? He would have said.
I'm sorry, Raff.
Jesse whispered.
I tried.
Jesse lowered the flashlight. He heard the assailant's howl die off after a minute or so, and he made a mental note of the direction it had last come from. Once backup arrived, he intended to go find the guy. If the suspect died before he arrived, that was just fine by him. He wasn't about to go after the madman alone, especially after witnessing what the man was capable of. How he had absorbed 4 rounds from Martinez's service pistol and then lived through a point-blank blast from Jesse's SLP, he couldn't imagine. Concluding that there was nothing to be done for Martinez, Jesse walked back around the tree where he had discovered Sasha. He found her still lying there, motionless, and knelt to examine her. She made no response to his presence, so he reached down to see if she would react to his touch. Jesse's hand was barely a few inches from Sasha's head when her eyes shot open and she started snarling at him. Jesse stopped, his hand remaining where it was.
It's okay, Sasha. It's me, Jesse said.
Sasha raised her head suddenly, snapping at Jesse's hand. He yanked it back, barely avoiding her teeth.
Hey, whoa, whoa, Chulita, he said soothingly.
Sasha stared at him momentarily, and then once again lowered her head to the ground. Jesse reached out a second time, and Sasha let him pet her. He sat down heavily next to her, suddenly feeling very exhausted.
It's been a long night, Sasha.
She lifted her head briefly, her big brown eyes surveying him. Jesse glanced at her as he stroked her head.
Good girl, he said.
She rested her head on the ground again.
There you go. Get some rest. Something tells me that this is just getting started.
Chapter 7. Pyotr Sion. Mirny Station, Antarctica. Omnis relinquente spes ovos intrantes.
Red snow. Pyotr Sion stared at it, confused. He was practically covered in it, though he didn't feel cold. He blinked, noting that his vision was blurred. He was also very uncomfortable. His legs were pulled up close to his chest in a fetal position, and his right arm was pinned underneath his body.
He blinked again and focused his gaze on the little red light floating just in front of his face. It was the radio's power indicator light, he realized.
I'm in the truck. Why is there snow in the truck? Why is the snow red?
He shifted, trying to pull his arm out from underneath his body. Pain blossomed furiously to life in his elbow and lanced up through his shoulder. Sion groaned.
Maria,
he mumbled. His mouth felt dry. There was something important that he needed to do, but what was it? He shook his head to try to stop the incessant buzzing that was dominating his mind. Another bad idea. The motion caused a fresh eruption of pain, this time in the back of his skull. He lay still for a minute, waiting for a wave of nausea to pass.
Slowly. I need to do this slowly.
He reached down with his free hand and braced it against whatever it was that he was lying on. He took a deep breath and very slowly lifted his body. There was pain, but this time it was bearable. He groaned again and moved his other arm forward, freeing it from underneath his body. He looked down. The hand was pale and foreign. He stared at it. Bits of snow clung to it, but he couldn't feel them. He could make the hand move, though. The fingers twitched at his command, but when he tried to make a fist, a sharp pain once again stabbed his elbow.
Broken. Shit.
Sion realized his world was coming a bit more into focus, and his mind felt a little clearer. He reached over with his good hand and toggled the radio's power button. The red light went dark, and the static hiss ceased, and he realized that he had turned it off. He frowned, his mind still foggy, and pressed the button again. The radio came back on. By habit, he pressed the button that switched the frequency to the base's all-purpose channel.
At least three more injured, Doctor. Evgeny's driving them over to you now.
I understand, Dr. Alex Belov replied.
The first voice belonged to Mirny's communications chief, a young Navy officer named Panarin.
No word from the old bear?
The doctor asked.
No, Doctor, not yet.
Misha.
Oh, God, Misha.
Memories flooded back into his mind. He had been driving to the diesel depot. Misha was there. Meteorites were falling from the sky. Maria was next to him. Cyan pulled himself up into a half-sitting position and slowly turned his head toward where Maria had been. She wasn't there, and her door was open, and the truck was lying upside down. Fear immediately awoke his senses.
Maria!
He called out as loudly as he could.
Maria!
There was no response. He grabbed the radio's handset and toggled the transmit button.
This is Cyan.
He waited, his brow furrowing as the other man kept talking.
Captain Lieutenant Panarin, can't you hear me?
He paused again, but Panarin still didn't reply.
Broken. The transmitter's broken, too. This is not my day.
Cyan looked over at the passenger door and decided that it represented the fastest way to get out of the stricken vehicle. He had to depend solely on his good arm, but he was able to pull himself forward, out into the snow. At least the snow felt cold again. That had to be a good sign. He turned onto his good side and sat up to survey his surroundings. The entire passenger side of the blue utility truck was mangled, and he saw glass and jagged chunks of fiberglass all around. The blast had sent the truck rolling into one of the big snowbanks that lined most of Lennon Street. The vehicle had come to a stop lying on its cab with its back end embedded in the snow. Cyan reached up and grabbed the passenger door, then slowly leveraged himself up until he was standing.
Maria!
He shouted. He turned and made his way around to the front of the truck. He smelled the pungent odor of leaking radiator fluid, and he could hear a small hissing sound.
Motor's still hot. I wasn't unconscious for that long.
He could see a trail of debris and crushed snow ahead, no doubt left behind by the rolling truck. He followed it, walking slowly and cradling his right arm against his chest to keep it from moving. Even the slightest bump, he realized quickly, sent additional pain shooting into his elbow. He walked at least 30 meters in the sub-zero morning air without finding Maria, and his heart was racing faster and faster with each step. He had to find her, and soon, if she was injured. Cyan turned toward the snowbank on the north side of the road and started to climb. It was an arduous chore with only one good hand. The snow was at least 5 or 6 meters high, and its steep pitch required him to crawl the last couple of meters in order to reach the top. Pulling himself into a sitting position, he scanned the area, and almost immediately spotted Maria's motionless body. She was lying on her back on the far side of the snowbank.
Maria!
He launched himself down the far side, wincing as he jarred his injured elbow repeatedly on the descent. It was over in a few seconds, but the pain left him doubled over, clutching at his arm and gasping for breath. Cyan stumbled forward, forcing himself to move toward Maria. He reached her side moments later, collapsing to his knees next to her, and peeled back the hood of her parka. Her eyes were closed. She looked peaceful, as though she were asleep.
Maria!
He whispered. He cupped her pale cheek, stroking her face. She moved, mumbled something that he couldn't understand, and then her eyes fluttered open. Cyan let out a shuddering sigh as tears streaked down his cheeks. A wave of emotion flooded him upon seeing her alive. She was beautiful, precious, irreplaceable, and his heart felt ready to burst with joy. He scooped her up out of the snow and embraced her tightly. He could feel the warmth of her body, despite her heavy coat. She was alive.
You're all right. I've got you. I've got you.
She mumbled something again, and Cyan strained to hear her.
That's twice now,
she repeated, looking up at him.
What?
He pulled back, studying her face.
You really need to learn.
She took a deep breath and continued.
How to drive, my love.
Cyan couldn't help but smile as more tears of relief welled in his eyes and spilled down his cheeks. Giddy with joy, he kissed her, and then pulled her into another embrace.
Are you hurt?
he eventually asked, helping her to her feet.
I don't think so. Just a bit dizzy, I suppose.
Remarkably, other than a nasty bump on her head and soreness in various places from her fall, it seemed she was unharmed. When she discovered that Sion was injured, though, she became very concerned.
We've got to get walking. The residence buildings aren't so far, she said.
He agreed, and they carefully clambered back up the snowbank, separating them from the ice road.
Look,
Maria said. She was straddling the top of the snowbank, pointing toward the science buildings, where columns of smoke billowed up to coalesce into a dark, ominous cloud.
I can't be sure, but there is at least three separate fires,
Sion said.
Yes.
Maria shifted and pointed in the opposite direction.
More over there.
It was true. A huge plume of black smoke had risen up from the diesel depot site and had blown out over the Davis Sea. Thin wisps of gray, smoky tendrils rose from the ground, tethering the black mass to the surface. Sion had been so dazed earlier and so focused on finding Maria that he hadn't noticed the smoke.
I've got to get to the vehicle barn.
Why?
Maria was making her way down the slope now, sliding on her knees toward the road. She suddenly stopped and looked up.
Misha, you haven't heard from him, have you?
No. I need to go look for him. He was so close to that explosion, he could...
Sion didn't finish. Instead, he finished sliding down to the road on his backside and grabbed Maria's hand.
I need to hurry. We need to hurry.
No, Belov needs to examine you. I'm getting you...
No!
She said, her face suddenly fierce with determination.
I said I'm going with you, and besides, you're hurt worse than I am, so don't try to use that excuse on me.
In their few arguments to date, Sion had already discovered how stubborn she could be. He smiled and started to shake his head, then winced as pulsating pain clamped down on the back of his neck.
See? If Belov is examining anyone, it's you, you mule. Now let's go.
She turned and started walking purposefully up the road, forcing him to catch up. They walked in silence for several minutes, drawing closer to the residence buildings, when a utility truck drove up to meet them. Roman Evgeny, one of the base's diesel mechanics, lowered the window as his truck slid to a stop next to them.
Thank God! Get the hell in! He called.
Sion wasted no time getting Maria into the back seat of the extended cab and climbed into the front seat.
Was Liskov with you, Pyotr?
Evgeny asked.
He was at the diesel depot.
Evgeny's eyes went wide.
I... Just drive! Get over there right now!
Sion ordered. As he drove, Evgeny radioed that he had found them. The burly, dark-featured man then gave Sion and Maria an update on the damage the base had sustained.
So far, we know of at least four science buildings that were hit, and many of the others were damaged by flying debris. There were so many injuries, Pyotr.
He glanced at Maria before continuing, as if unsure whether he should delve into too many gory details in the presence of a woman.
Many died. I don't know how many, but it's a mess over there. Residence 2 was also hit by one of those things, although thankfully no one was injured. And the diesel depot. Well, you can see that for yourself.
He pointed out through the truck's windshield. They were closer to the depot now, and the damage was much more evident. The large weather tower, on which the faulty camera was mounted, lay crumpled on its side. Even through the smoke, Sion could immediately see that there were too few buildings. Many of the small maintenance shacks were gone, replaced by blackened snow and piles of debris. Worse, he could see only one of the two huge cylindrical diesel tanks. Evgeny approached the depot from the east, then turned and drove around toward the far side, trying to get a better view of the damage.
Watch out!
Maria shouted suddenly. Evgeny jerked his gaze forward and immediately slammed on his brakes. The truck slid several meters and stopped, its front tires mere centimeters from the edge of the ice shelf. Cursing, he hastily shifted the truck into reverse and punched the gas, backing the vehicle away from the precipice.
Sheared off! The whole damn thing is gone!
He shouted, stopping the truck. It was true. Sion jumped out to get a better look. Maria protested and then hopped out behind him. The diesel depot previously sat a mere 50 meters from the edge of the Davis Sea on a 30-meter-high ice shelf. Now, A jagged, icy cliff wound its way through the center of the complex. Only fragments of storage tank A remained. Several other buildings had evidently fallen into the sea when the cliff collapsed. There was no sign of Misha's vehicle.
One of those meteorites must have hit the tank. Look at the way the remaining siding is peeled outward,
Cyan observed.
Hit it, then probably continued straight through into the ice. The impact and the explosion together must have compromised the shelf, and it just crumbled,
Maria said.
Taking most of our diesel with it,
Evgeny added. He cursed, throwing his brawny arms into the air.
If the other tank has been reached, we'll all freeze to death in a matter of days.
On foot, the group made its way around the perimeter of the complex and inspected the other diesel tank. It was intact, but the pressure gauges revealed that the tank was only at 12% capacity. The men exchanged a worried look.
What does it mean?
Maria asked.
It means that either we leave, or Moscow Science Service sends a refueling ship,
Cyan answered, tapping the gauge's glass to see if the indicator needle would move.
How long do we have?
Evgeny asked. He slipped a glove off and wrapped the tank with his fist. The metallic echo was a deep, hollow rumble.
Not long. A few weeks, maybe 2 months if we conserve power.
Cyan was already moving away from the tank, looking around as he moved through the debris. Maria moved up to his side and slipped a gloved hand around his elbow. They walked in silence for a while, and then she whispered,
He's gone, isn't he?
Cyan didn't respond. He hoped to find the commander still alive, but it was obvious by the sheer destruction around him that it was very unlikely.
They will look to you to lead them,
she added. Cyan shook his head.
I'm not military, Maria. They won't care. We'll see,
he replied. He couldn't imagine himself leading anyone, anywhere. But he knew she was right. Most of the base staff had already regarded him as Misha's second in command. He glanced down at her and saw sadness in her faint smile. Her eyes were wet. He moved his good arm behind her and pulled her closer as they walked. Maria had been correct. Dr. Belov and the other staff members assailed him with questions as soon as they arrived at the medical station.
Where's the old bear? What do we do? The science services know yet? Will they send a rescue ship?
Lieutenant Azia Talanov, the facility's head nurse, x-rayed Cyan's arm. Belov checked the results and declared,
It's fractured, but not badly, you lucky bastard.
Cyan insisted that the doctor also examine Maria. The doctor was noticeably gentler with her.
My dear, you have a mild concussion. Nothing to worry about.
He glanced meaningfully at Cyan.
If you get proper rest.
An hour later, Cyan and Maria were entering the command center. Cyan's arm was in a temporary sling, and the painkillers Belov had given him had reduced the pain in his elbow from knife-like jabs to more of a blunt force throbbing. Cyan felt intensely fatigued, yet adrenaline rushed at the same time. The command center was in chaos when he pushed through the door. Three of the military team leaders were engaged in excited discussion with the science team's director, while Panarin sat at the communication station, shouting into the transmitter. At least half of the monitors above the desk, Cyan noted, were bathed in static.
Moscow, say again!
He shouted. He turned to glance behind him, saw Cyan, and waved him over.
Thank God, Pyotr! I had Moscow Science Services on the line briefly and then lost them. Something's gone wrong with the satellite relays, or maybe with the birds themselves. The connections are very unreliable. Is it possible that those meteorites could have taken out some of our communication satellites?
Not just possible, Captain Lieutenant. Probable.
Maria had followed Cyan to the communication station and sat down at the desk next to Panarin. She was already twisting dials and adjusting settings on the control panel.
I've never seen a storm with such density.
I'm not so sure about that, Maria,
Alexei Vagin said, striding over to join the conversation. He was the director of science for the current scientific season. Bespectacled, hawkish, and brilliant, many of the base's other scientists considered him to be on the Nobel Prize track, following in the footsteps of laureates like Ilya Ilyich Menshikov and Ivan Pavlov. Most would not admit that to his face, however, for fear that his already greatly swollen head would cease to fit through the base's doorways.
The odds of a direct hit are...
Maria scowled, and Cyan closed his eyes, waiting for Maria's retort. If there was one thing his girlfriend was passionate about, it was meteorites. He didn't have to wait long.
Director Vagan,
she interrupted,
pardon me, but there have been several documented incidents in which satellites have sustained damage from near misses. Sonic vibrations and ejected debris from objects passing even 50 meters away have caused calibration and orientation issues with both newer and older model satellites. I'm telling you, a direct hit is not required.
She finished, folding her arms across her chest. Vagan scoffed, but said nothing. Panarin, fidgeting uncomfortably in the room's sudden tension, cut in.
Then we have a much greater problem.
Everyone turned to face him.
From what little I could gather from Moscow and our comm relay station in Christchurch, this meteorite event was not local to Antarctica. What are you saying? Spit it out!
Vagan insisted.
This event was global. Moscow was all but destroyed. For that matter, so was New York City, London, Tokyo, both Sydney and Christchurch, Los Angeles, Buenos Aires. The entire world was affected.
Vagan paled. His mouth hung open, but he was unable to speak. Maria shook her head.
Panarin, are you sure you heard correctly? It is not possible that a single meteorite cloud could strike the planet from every angle all at once. That simply cannot happen.
It happened,
he stated flatly.
Moscow is quite clear on that. The city is in ruins. Every city is in ruins. Science Services is privy to more of the military communications channels than we are. They would know.
For a moment, no one made a sound. And then Cyan broke the silence.
Then we're alone.
He was staring at Maria, who was looking back at him, her expression painted with worry. Vagan turned on him. His movements were jerky with fear and nervousness.
What do you mean? We are alone. What makes you...
Because, you fool, with the entire world in chaos, who is going to worry about a bunch of scientists in the middle of Antarctica?
Maria said harshly.
For all we know, science services may not even exist 24 hours from now.
Vagan shook his head quickly, seeming not to register the insult. He was sweating now and spoke rapidly.
Then we'll ride it out. We'll wait for them to get the situation under control. This facility is well stocked. We'll maintain communications and...
Cyan raised his good hand to stop the outburst. He spoke slowly and quietly.
The depot was hit, and the primary fuel storage tank exploded. As a result, we are now very low on fuel for the diesel-electric power generators. If we aren't evacuated within the next 2 months, we'll freeze to death. We won't have enough fuel to last through the winter.
For several moments, everyone stared at him.
Wait! No! No!
Vagan stammered. Large beads of sweat had formed on his forehead. His neck was flushed, and his eyes were so big they looked like they were about to pop out of their sockets.
They won't leave us? They can't!
Maria was shaking her head, clearly upset by her boss's panic attack.
What part of Moscow is in ruins did you fail to comprehend?
She snapped.
This is outrageous! This cannot happen!
He retorted. Maria jumped to her feet.
Shut up! Shut up already!
That's enough, Cyan said. He stepped in between them, facing Maria, and put a hand on her shoulder. For a moment he thought she would protest his intervention. Her eyes burned up at him, tight and angry. Cyan gave her a gentle smile, and Maria finally relented. She was still smoldering, but she looked like she was getting her emotions under control. He turned back to the group and raised his free hand in a pacifying gesture.
Listen, I'm not sure what our options are, but we will do what we can. First, let's see what damage the base has sustained, and how many casualties there are. We'll meet here again at, say, 5 p.m.
Vagan turned and stormed out, muttering something that Cyan didn't catch.
Let him go,
Maria said. He nodded. It took another 10 minutes to coordinate what each of them needed to do. Lieutenant Datsik, the base quartermaster, would inspect the residence buildings and other facilities located within the Spalnia. Senior Seaman Zarkov and Lieutenant Kozar would organize two teams and check the science buildings, as well as the area around them, for survivors. Once the group dispersed, Cyan took Maria over to Misha's quarters and instructed her to rest. It would be a long day, he said. She would need her strength. Asya Talanov was exhausted. She had been assisting Dr. Belov for 6 straight hours in the base's makeshift operating room, where he had performed 5 harrowing operations. When the last patient, a young marine biologist, died on the operating table, Belov had torn his mask off and thrown up his hands in disgust.
We saved 2 out of 5. What is that, 40%? Goddamn 40%!
She understood his frustration. Mirny was small enough that everyone knew everyone else. Each of their patients had been friends or co-workers. They played cards with him in the lounge, bumped into them in the commissary, joked with them in the corridors. Watching helplessly as they died on the operating table had not been easy. Talanov signed her name on the bottom of her daily medical services report and shoved it into a little plastic tray on her desk. She sighed and ran her fingers through her short, dirty hair. Her hands ached and her feet throbbed. At least the building had quieted down. Closing her eyes, she leaned back in her chair and listened to the wind howling outside Residence 1. The unexpected storm had hit an hour ago, promptly ending the search and rescue activities going on all over the base. There had been 27 confirmed injuries. Belov had annexed most of the dormitory rooms of Residence 1 in order to acquire additional bed space, and his small nursing staff, headed by Talanov, was running ragged trying to care for all of the patients. The part she liked the least was that no one had time to remove the corpses. Mirny didn't have a morgue, so medical team protocol stated that corpses would be stored outside in a cold house to keep them from decaying too badly before they could be transported back home. Evgeny and Pyotr Sion had come by earlier to check on things and had promised to send a team of men to remove the bodies. Talanov smiled as she recalled her earlier antics. She had insisted on examining Pyotr's bandages, even though she knew his arm was fine. Very fine. She had known him for 3 years and had tried unsuccessfully to draw the attention of the handsome, intelligent, but quirky man. She had been depressed for weeks after discovering that he was dating that skinny, arrogant Romanova bitch.
She studies space rocks. How hard can that be? Relax, Tally, relax, forget him.
Talanov began massaging her temples. She had only a couple of minutes to spare before she would have to make her rounds once more. The building shook as the wind picked up again. The weather in Antarctica was erratic and dangerous. Talanov hated it, and that howling. She frowned, sat up in her chair, and listened. The noise was louder now, and as it came and went on the gusty air, it sounded strange, almost human.
Or maybe it is a wolf? Does Antarctica have wolves?
She wearily pushed herself up and walked to the small exterior window. The darkness outside was dispelled only by a few distant exterior lights, and she saw nothing unusual in the swirling, wind-whipped snow. The howl soon returned, though, this time even louder.
Not louder, closer.
The answering shriek that pierced the air from within Residence 1 was as loud and sudden as a train whistle. Talanov immediately spun to face the doorway, holding her hands to her ears, trying to stop the horrible sound from reaching her mind. It was awful, mournful, a long, gurgling cry that ended several seconds later in a high-pitched whine. She had never heard anything so terrifying. The shiver that spidered across her back left her quivering, momentarily immobilized. Then the cry was repeated from the other end of the building, not by one voice, but by several. It was an unholy sound, animal howls crying out in a ghoulish chorus.
Inside, something is in here.
Talanov crossed herself as her lips fumbled for the words of a prayer. Her instinct was screaming for her to find a hiding place, but her mind countermanded the order. She was responsible for the patients in the adjacent rooms, the men and women whose lives she had struggled all day to save. She had a duty to find out what was going on. Her eyes quickly scanned the small nurse's station and found a pair of scissors on her desk. Slowly, quietly, she made her way over to the desk and snatched them up with shaking hands. Her steps were stuttered and irregular as she walked to the doorway, while her pathetic weapon remained clutched to her chest. She bent forward to look out into the building's central corridor. It was empty. There were rummaging sounds coming from one of the rooms a few meters to her right, and then a metallic clang that sounded like an overturned bedpan. Emerging from the nurse's station, she headed left toward Belov's office. She was breathing rapidly, close to hyperventilation, so she forced herself to take a deep breath. Releasing it slowly, she resumed her slow walk, sliding her way down the corridor's left-hand wall. Belov's office was just three doors down. He would know what was going on and what to do. Surely she was overreacting.
Yes, overreacting. It's nothing. A practical joke.
Talanov spun as she heard a door click open behind her. One of the other nurses was poking her head out of a room near the far end of the hallway. She looked pale, her eyes wide with fright. Nevertheless, seeing her friend made Talanov feel a little better. The woman stared at her, and then she screamed. Talanov nearly jumped at the unexpected sound, even as her mind struggled to discover the reason why the other nurse was suddenly screaming at the top of her lungs. When Talanov realized that the woman was still looking in her direction, a new, paralytic chill invaded her spine. Its sinewy fingers wrapped around and between her vertebrae, locking them into place, immobilizing her entire body. The nurse wasn't looking at her. She was looking past her. And then she felt the presence behind her. Talanov's breathing was suddenly ragged. She couldn't force her body to move, so she shifted her gaze sideways. A shadow moved on the wall next to her. Dread, cold and certain, filled her consciousness. Talanov somehow coaxed her body into temporary motion. She stepped forward, away from whoever was behind her, and, with an air of hesitant resignation, slowly turned around. It was the meteorologist guy, the one from Maria Romanova's team. He had died in surgery. Internal hemorrhaging, systemic shock, organ failure, blood loss. The man had been struck in the abdomen with a piece of flying metal that had damaged many of his vital organs and poisoned his body with fecal matter from his digestive system. He was standing in front of her, his head cocked slightly askew, staring at her neck. His upper intestines had spilled out of his wound and now hung in long, pallid loops, dragging on the floor between his naked, bloody legs. The scissors fell unnoticed from Talanov's fingers. She tried to force her mind, her body, to react. Neither would obey her commands. As if broken from a trance, the man in front of her jerked, and then his gaze slowly rose. His eyes slid up her neck and slowly ascended the architecture of her face. They were a dull, dry brown, and Talanov found her gaze fixed on something silvery glinting in the right cornea. A splinter of metal, she thought distantly. Shrapnel from the explosion. And then his eyes met hers, and a new wave of horror shocked her senses. She stared, not at a man's eyes, but at dual tunnels to the kingdom of the dead. The black canals once ushered in rays of light that dazzled bundles of optic nerves in the man's brain, seducing them into painting images of the living world around him. They now admitted nothing. It was like a channel lock had been turned, and those inbound streams of light had now reversed their flow to become twin forks of the river Styx. They seemed to speak to her, these black brothers. Together they formed the terminus of an ancient evil's cleft tongue, an evil that once roamed the pathways of an ancient garden, spewing forth acidic lies and seductive promises of greatness, of equality with the living God. These eyes spoke of a horrible darkness, expounding not on death with its simple gracefulness, but on a thrashing, malevolent hatred of all that is living. And then his mouth opened, and he shrieked at her. It was the same sound she had heard before, that same deafening, awful, high-pitched wail. He bent forward with the effort, jutting his head toward her. She could see his neck muscles bulge as he screamed. The man stepped forward, his arms reaching out as his icy cold breath washed over her. Her eyes now focused on his mouth, on his dirty, bloody teeth. She tried to step away, and then she was falling backward. The man clutched at her blouse and fell with her. A wave of pain and dizziness washed over her as she landed hard on the metal-plated floor. She could feel his weight on her and realized that he was kneeling on her legs, his knees digging painfully into her thighs. His hands were crooked, bunched up into bird-like claws. They pushed her face aside and tore at her collar, exposing her neck. Her arms were working now, pushing at him, punching his face and torso, trying to force him off of her. It was too late. She felt his dirty teeth on her neck. There was an intense, pinching sensation, then a wet, tearing sound, as searing pain rocketed through her body from the wound. The agony was unbearable. She clutched at his hospital gown, her hands constricting into balls. She could feel the rubbery coolness of his dead body through the material. Distantly, she heard the other nurse screaming, and then her scream changed into a frightened shout. And then there were many shouts. People were yelling, crying, shrieking in pain. She could feel vibrations in the floor as they ran, and her mind painted a picture of a panicked mob in the streets of her hometown of Smolensk. She could hear equipment toppling over to slam onto the floor. Belov was shouting, and the shrieking sounds, now mixed with guttural, predatorial grunts and calls, were everywhere at once. Through it all, the thing on top of her kept biting, pulling, chewing.
Hell! I mean hell!
And then she recalled a quote from Dante. It was from The Divine Comedy, one of her favorite works.
Omnis relinquente spes, o vos intrantis.
She would have smiled at the bitter irony if her facial muscles were still intact. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. The animal on top of her bit down again, and her head flopped to the side as he severed the large sternocleidomastoid muscle in her neck. Lieutenant Talanov felt a tickle on her cheek and realized that she was crying.
This is Pyotr Sion, chief engineer of Mirny Station. Can anyone hear me?
He released the transmit button, waited a minute, then repeated the call. It had been 3 hours since they'd had contact with anyone else. Panarin came back into the room, his footsteps echoing on the metal floor. He was holding a picture from one of the weather station's high-resolution color printers.
One IR image. That's all we received.
Sion turned and removed his headset.
What? We typically receive 7 satellite images per day. 2 water vapor, 3 infrared, and 2 visible imagery, all from different birds. We only received 1 this afternoon.
Sion nodded, staring at the floor as he contemplated the new information.
Then Maria was right. Many of our satellites have been damaged. I also checked some of our global positioning devices. Dead. They aren't getting a feed.
Panarin added.
The GPS birds are gone too, then. Wonderful.
Sion replied. In the Antarctic, GPS navigation equipment was vital for long-range movement. Without it, any attempt to re-establish a connection with the outside world would be severely hampered and much more dangerous. Likewise, any attempt by the outside world to locate Mirny Station and rescue its residents would be similarly impeded. He turned back to his radio as Panarin sat down at the desk next to him.
Command Center!
The voice boomed through Sion's headsets. He immediately dialed the volume down. It sounded like Belov.
This is Sion. What is it? We are under attack! God help us!
Belov shouted. Sion could hear screams and a cacophony of other unidentifiable noises in the background.
Belov, what are you talking about?
Panarin asked, quickly donning his own headset.
Don't let them out! Whatever you do!
Belov sounded distant now, as though he had moved away from his transmitter. There was a thumping sound in the background.
Not alive! Not anymore! I've barricaded my office!
He shouted.
Don't come here!
Sion looked over at Panarin.
Don't come here?
Panarin shrugged, equally mystified.
Belov, what the hell are you talking about?
Sion asked. Belov didn't reply. For a few seconds, the men continued listening to the background noises. Distant shouting. More thumps. They could clearly hear a woman's terrified scream. And then the transmission cut out.
I'm going over there,
Sion said, standing and quickly removing his headset. Panarin turned to face Sion.
Are you sure that's wise? What about your arm? Send Evgeny instead.
Sion wasn't listening. He was frozen, his eyes locked on the video surveillance monitor to the far right of the console.
Pyotr?
Panarin frowned, swiveling his chair around to see what had suddenly caught Sion's attention. He saw a dark figure staggering through the blowing snow directly in front of Camera 23. The figure was wearing a fuchsia-colored scarf. Chapter 8. The Little Princess, the Giant, and the Guardian. Annie felt a familiar tug on the back of her hair. It was soothing and gentle, and Mama's hands felt soft whenever they brushed against her cheek. Mama was sitting behind her, brushing out her long, black hair in smooth, even strokes. When she was done, Mama would braid it and tie two of the big braids together, looping them around her head to form a crown. Oh, how she loved that part. And Mama was wearing Emmy's favorite perfume, the one she had bought for her with her very own money. Grandma had taken her into town that year and let her pick out the gift. Smelling the sweet fragrance, she was suddenly awash in a sea of memories. Mama bought a puppy for her once. Emmy had a little garden where she tried to grow things, and Mama sometimes helped. Mama had a horse named Petey. He had big brown eyes. She would let Emmy ride him as she walked alongside, holding the reins. There was a peach tree in front of their big white house. Sometimes Mama would lift her up so that she could pick the small, fuzzy fruit off of it. "All done, little princess," Mama announced. Her words were warm and loving, her voice soft and sweet like honey. Emmy closed her eyes and smiled, knowing what would come next. Sure enough, Mama made her braided crown, kissed the top of her head, and wrapped her arms around her. Emmy's smile deepened as she reveled in the warmth of the embrace. Mama's arms were so strong and comforting. After all these years, Emmy was finally home. Still holding her, Mama started to whisper,
"Emmy, my baby, I need for you to know something."
Finally, she would get another chance to hear Mama's words, the ones she told her never to forget. They were spoken years ago, and no matter how hard she tried, she hadn't been able to remember them. She tensed with anticipation, waiting for Mama to continue. Mama started to speak, but something was wrong. Her words became slurred, and they faded in and out. "Mama?" Emmy tried to turn around, but she couldn't move. Mama's house, the walls, the pictures, the furniture, everything was sliding downward into a dark nothingness. Descending blackness erased everything, and then the darkness was filled with tiny points of light. The stars twinkled, but as Emmy looked up at them, they too began to slide downward. They melted from the heavens as they blurred into long green streaks.
"But green means life. Life, not death.
Mama?" Emmy started to cry.
"Mama!"
she screamed. Emmy was desperate now. She leapt up, spun around, and stared wide-eyed at Grandma's corpse. She was sitting in Mama's rocking chair. Her limp neck was bent over like a colorless dead stalk, causing her head to rest unnaturally on her shoulder. The skeletal hand that clutched Mama's hairbrush twitched as it lay in her lap. Emmy was breathing hard as sudden terror constricted her chest. Her eyes shifted up from the hairbrush to Grandma's face. Her mouth was agape, exposing blackened, toothless gums. Her lidless eyes were shiny black orbs which reflected the brilliant green streaks that were falling all around her. Emmy was shaking her head.
This couldn't be. Grandma was back home, lying on her bed.
Emmy's legs felt like lead. She wanted to run, to get away, but she couldn't move, couldn't turn away from those black eyes. Emmy screamed as the rocking chair suddenly lurched forward, sending Grandma's lifeless face up toward her. Emmy turned away, clenching her eyes shut.
"M.M.?"
Carter was shaking her gently.
"M.M.?"
She was slapping him, trying to push his big baby face away from her as she continued screaming. It took several moments before she had calmed down enough to realize that it had all been a nightmare.
"It wasn't Mama. It was Grandma. It was Grandma,"
she whimpered, holding her hands to her face. Carter tilted his head quizzically.
"In my dream, Mama was brushing my hair, but... and then all of a sudden it was Grandma. Said Grandma was dead."
"That's awful, child," the man said. Startled, Emmy sat up quickly and looked around. She was lying on a brown couch in someone's living room. The room was dark, save for the small, lonely light of a Virgin of Guadalupe candle on a glass coffee table next to her. The place smelled yucky, like Grandma's house smelled whenever Carter hid the trash bags in the broom closet instead of taking them out to the dumpster like he was supposed to. Grandma's friend, Mr. Hodges, came around a corner holding another candle in one hand and a mug in the other. When he got closer, she could see a faded picture of Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer on the side of the cup.
Hot chocolate. Thank God I got a gas stove. Power's been out all night.
He waited until Emmy scooted herself up into a seated position, and then handed her the mug.
Careful now. Contents may be hot and all that.
Mr. Hodges chuckled to himself while Emmy took a careful sip. He was right. It was very hot.
We're in your house?
She asked, looking up at the old man. He was wearing greasy blue overalls and a green flannel shirt that hung loosely on his bony frame. As always, his long gray beard was scraggly and wild. The man had small eyes beneath bushy eyebrows and a comb-over of thin, oily hair that Emmy always thought smelled like an old-fashioned barber shop whenever he picked them up for a trip into town.
Yeah, he drawled. Y'all are safe now.
Mr. Hodges hooked a thumb onto his overalls as he looked down at her.
I was just driving your way to check on y'all when I came up on Carter here, walking down the road with you in his arms. How you two came through all that fire, I do not know.
He gave Carter a thoughtful glance and continued,
Fire came pretty dang close to here, too, but it stopped short.
Is it morning time now?
Emmy was looking around again, trying to get her bearings. Mr. Hodges shook his head.
Just about. You slept most of the night. Fitfully, too, I might add. A toss-in and a turn-in, mostly.
Emmy felt sudden relief settle into her. Mr. Hodges was an adult. He would take care of everything now. She felt an urgent need to tell him all that had happened. The torrent of words didn't stop until Emmy was teary-eyed and out of breath.
So, your grandmother's passed on, you're sure?
He asked.
Yes, sir. I'm positive.
He tugged at the bottom of his long beard and he nodded thoughtfully.
I'd call the sheriff, child, but the phone's out.
Carter was sitting on a sofa chair next to the couch. Mr. Hodges looked at him, then at Emmy, and said,
You kids are all right here. I'm going to go pick up a friend of mine, and then we're going to check on your grandmother. Probably the fire's moved on enough that I can make it through now.
Anxiety came creeping back into her mind.
You're going to leave us here?
Mr. Hodges raised a conciliatory hand.
It'll be okay. We got to get you over to the hospital, young lady, and have them quacks look at your legs. First, though, I got to see if what you're saying about your grandmother is really true. Maybe she was just knocked out, or maybe passed out from the fright of it all.
Emmy was shaking her head. She looked over at Carter for support, but although her brother looked skeptical, he merely shrugged his big shoulders.
I don't know,
she said slowly.
Look, Emmy, I just got to make sure.
He stared at her for a long moment, as if lost in thought, and then she saw what looked to be sadness momentarily wash over his features. Lowering his voice, he said,
When I come back, I'm going to do something that should have been done a long time ago.
Emmy stared up at him uncomprehendingly.
I'm going to take you two to the hospital. Then, I'm going to take you two to Sunderson.
Sunderson?
She asked.
Sunderson, Texas, child. It's about 80 miles east of here. Your father's got a ranch over there that's near as big as all of Sunrisa.
You can't tell me you didn't know that, he said. Emmy had never heard the word Sunderson in all of her life, and never knew anything about her daddy. She looked up at him in mute confusion.
Well, I'll be.
He shook his head.
She never told you, did she, that old bitch?
Emmy shook her head. She had no idea what he was talking about.
Look, I'll explain it all later when I come back. Just give me 10 minutes.
Mr. Hodges walked over to the front door. There was a bright yellow raincoat hanging from the rack of a mounted deer's head. He took it and grabbed a set of keys off of a nail that was sticking out of the wall beneath the buck's neck.
Y'all sit right tight.
Emmy watched him leave. She heard his beat-up old car rattle to life a minute later, and then listened as the sound diminished. The house was quickly immersed in a heavy silence. She looked at her brother.
Are you okay?
She whispered. Carter nodded and pointed to her.
M.M.,
he said softly, as he lifted his arms to pantomime himself carrying her. She nodded, understanding.
You got that tree off of me, didn't you?
He nodded and smiled broadly.
Go, go, go,
he whispered, still pantomiming, swaying his arms back and forth as if he was carrying a baby. She smiled back at him.
Thank you, Carter.
Her brother stood, pushing his big body up from the sofa chair to come around the coffee table. He reached down and drew back the thin blanket that covered Emmy's legs. She looked down and frowned. Both of her legs beneath her knees were wrapped in a patchwork collection of gauze strips, small bath towels, and what looked like one of Mr. Hodge's old T-shirts. Most were wet to the touch, and Emmy could smell a sickly sweet odor emanating from them. Carter smiled approvingly.
Mr. Hodges did this?
She asked. Carter gave a thumbs-up sign and nodded.
Good. Good. Good,
he said with a proud smile. Emmy was unconvinced. She looked down again at the bandages and started to peel one back. The cloth stuck to some sticky stuff on her leg for a moment, until the skin gave way. She gritted her teeth as hot pain washed over her leg.
Bring over that candle,
she said, leaning forward to try to get a better look at the wound. Her brother obediently held the candle overhead. Her skin was a puffy, angry shade of red in places, and in others it was missing altogether, replaced by gray and pus-white globs. She could see black specks, bits of leaves and rocks, and other unidentifiable things stuck in the open wounds. She replaced the bandage, wincing at the pain.
Mr. Hodges is right. I gotta go to the hospital.
Carter bobbed his head, still smiling.
Yep, okay.
Pulling the blanket up over her legs, Emmy took another sip from her Rudolph mug as she looked around the room once more. Weak, reddish light was filtering in through the windows, illuminating a small kitchen and nearby dining room table. Mounds of paper, cardboard boxes, tools, and other things covered every available surface of the table and counters. An old riding lawnmower sat in the middle of the unfinished plank floor next to the dining room. Its hood was up, and the motor was missing. She scanned the living room next. Creepy, crawly shadows hung from the ceiling and grew thicker in the corners. Emmy could see cobwebs hanging from a light fixture above her head and wondered when Mr. Hodges had last cleaned it. Grandma's place was so orderly and clean compared to this house. Or at least it used to be. Rain began to plink and pop on the house's metal roof, and within moments it increased to the loud din of a steady downpour. The room's shadows deepened as darkness glided in to regain its dominion over the parts of the house that fell outside the domain of Emmy's sole candle.
I hope he comes back soon,
she said, putting her mug down. She shivered as the damp, cool air within the house stirred. Outside, the rain came down even harder. She had a sudden thought and turned to Carter.
Sam! Where's Sam?
His face lit up in a smile once more. He walked over to his chair and then returned.
Amru,
he said, as he handed the stuffed kangaroo to her. Emmy smiled as she took it from him and hugged it to her chest. She rocked gently back and forth as she shut her eyes and noticed that he smelled like wood smoke. Still, Sam always made her feel better.
We're gonna be okay, Sam,
she whispered. She looked down at its little plastic eyes and stitched mouth and smiled. Then her expression changed into one of mock sternness, and she wagged a finger at Sam's little face.
Don't you ever leave me now, understand? You better get that through your little head.
She hugged the kangaroo to her chest again as her finger found Sam's little pouch.
Don't you leave me,
she whispered. Emmy had almost drifted off to sleep again when a strange, terrible howling floated into the house like a ghost on the wind. It was high-pitched and distant, a mournful wail that made Emmy sit bolt upright. She turned toward the front door. It was difficult to tell, but she thought the strange sound had come from that direction. Carter, too, was looking that way. He was motionless, staring at the door. The cry undulated up and down within the backdrop of the steady rain, stopping, restarting, and then finally fading away. Emmy didn't move. The cry had come from a person, that much she knew. No animal could make a sound like that. She also knew that it was a woman's voice, certainly not a man's. Her imagination conjured the image of a woman, sitting in the dark rain, wailing at the top of her lungs. She remembered seeing a scary show one night after Grandma had gone to sleep. It was about a mother that had drowned her own children one night.
La Llorona, that was her name.
She was a spirit lady who went around crying all the time, looking for bad kids to steal. Back then, Emmy had thought it was a really stupid story. Now, though, she wasn't so sure. Another minute passed as she waited tensely. When the sound didn't return, she finally let out her breath.
It wasn't anything,
she breathed.
Just a trick of the...
She spun around as the cry returned, this time emanating from behind the house. It was also much closer.
Mama?
Carter asked suddenly. Shocked, Emmy turned to face him.
What did you say?
Carter didn't answer. He stared toward the back of the house as the wailing continued. It didn't last as long this time, and when it ended, Carter turned and strode purposefully toward the front door.
Carter, no!
Emmy's senses flooded with panic. He was in front of the door in three big strides.
Don't leave me!
The front door flew open just as Carter reached for it. Emmy screamed as a figure lurched in through the opening and grabbed the front of her brother's shirt. Carter bellowed in surprise as he stepped back, waving his arms over his head.
Get your sister, now! Mr. Hodges growled. Now, boy!
Carter staggered back from the old man as he released his grip on his shirt. Mr. Hodges pitched forward the rest of the way into the house, knocking over a small table near the door. He was dragging his right leg behind him, and his face looked ashen as he came closer to the weak illumination of the candle. His eyes were wide with fear as he glanced quickly around the room.
What happened?
She stammered. Her throat constricted with a new tightness, and she had the sudden urge to pee. He ignored the question. He was shaking his head, mumbling under his breath. Carter came around the couch and stood in front of Emmy as the old man limped into the kitchen. She watched him throw open a cabinet door and pull out something long and black. He turned around, holding a rifle.
I said, get your sister, Carter. We're leaving right now.
Thump. Something solid struck the back of the house. Mr. Hodges spun, lifting the rifle toward the noise as Emmy squealed involuntarily.
Mr. Hodges, what's wrong?
She whispered hoarsely, trying to control her fright. Now she really had to go tinkle.
Shush,
he growled, never taking his eyes from the dark tunnel that led to the back bedrooms.
Child,
he started to whisper, before another loud thump drew their attention, this time toward the front of the house. They spun that way, and Emmy caught a look of despair on the old man's face as he stared at the wide-open front door. Gusts of wind carried gray rain into the house and stirred the curtains drooping from nearby windows. The draperies were colorless in the near darkness of the room. The black skirts of witches, they were animated by some soundless tune, ushered inside by the same ill wind that now surrounded the little house. Long moments passed as the three of them watched the curtains billow and swirl in an impromptu dance macabre, while Mr. Hodges steadfastly pointed his rifle at the gaping maw of the front entrance. Then, something creaked just outside. It was the groan of old wood bending beneath a sudden weight. Click! Metal on metal. Emmy jerked her gaze toward the sound and saw Mr. Hodges holding his rifle up in front of his eyes.
Damn it!
He exclaimed. He started backing up slowly, his gaze still locked on the front doorway. He reached the kitchen, spun around, and yanked open a nearby kitchen drawer. Emmy saw him grab a small box, and then heard metallic tinkling sounds as some of the box's contents spilled out onto the kitchen floor.
Bullets! Those are bullets!
A sudden crash of breaking glass erupted from one of the back rooms.
Run!
Mr. Hodges shouted.
Get in the car!
Carter scooped Emmy up and was bounding toward the front door before she could even respond. She looked back just in time to catch a glimpse of shadowy movement in the back bedroom.
Bang!
The noise of the gunshot chased them out as Carter ducked into the early morning air. It smelled so strongly of wood smoke that it nearly made Emmy gag. Carter bounded off of Mr. Hodges' front porch, landed, and nearly lost his balance on the slippery grass. Emmy gasped as ice-cold rain saturated her hair and clothing. She held onto Sam as hard as she could, desperate not to drop him. Carter bolted across the front yard toward a pair of dim lights at the end of the driveway, and Emmy realized Mr. Hodges' car was still running. Its weak headlights were barely able to cut through the heavy rain and drifting fog. They were halfway to the car before she glanced back, and her eyes widened as she glimpsed a woman slipping around the front corner of the house. She saw her for only a split second, yet she knew there was something terrible about her. She could feel it in her chest. Carter reached the car and opened the small sedan's back door. He placed her into the back seat, scooted her over, and then crammed himself in next to her. Emmy winced at the loud bang as her brother slammed the door shut.
"Lock the door, Carter."
Her brother was staring at the house. He didn't move. More loudly and more urgently, she said, "Carter, lock the door!" He finally complied, but as the minutes passed, Emmy started to wonder if they would be better off just making a run for it. Carter could run very quickly, faster than anyone she knew. She had no idea what was going on, but she'd never seen an adult look as scared as Mr. Hodges had, and that howling sound was the most frightening thing she had ever heard. She tried to remember if La Llorona could run, and if so, if she was very fast. Try as she might, though, she couldn't recall much about the movie. Still, she was pretty sure Carter could outrun the bad people, whoever they were. Emmy was shivering as she sat on the wet vinyl seat. Her wide eyes were locked on Mr. Hodges' distant house. The car's windshield wipers were on, but they weren't moving fast enough to keep the deluge of water off the glass. As a result, the unlit house looked blurry and undefined, like some dark, formless mass. A flash of something round and pale caused Emmy to jerk her gaze to the right. A face? It was off in the underbrush next to the driveway, about 30 feet up ahead. She blinked, and it was gone.
"Maybe we should go,"
she whispered. The shivers racking her body weren't solely due to the cold. To comfort herself, Emmy scooted herself up against her brother and wrapped one arm around his massive bicep. More tense minutes passed as they waited.
"If Mr. Hodges hasn't come out by now, maybe he won't be coming out at all,"
she thought for a moment, and then added,
"Maybe we should go and get some help."
That last idea made her feel better. She didn't want to abandon Mr. Hodges. That didn't feel right. But if she was going to get help... A shadow shifted in the darkness to her left, and Emmy suppressed a shriek. She glanced out through her window, then averted her gaze, afraid of what she might see. La Llorona's white face, her mouth twisted into a cruel vampire-toothed snarl, filled her imagination.
"There's no one there. I'm not a bad girl. There's no one there. There's no one."
She turned to her brother and tapped his meaty thigh rapidly.
"I think we should go. Mr. Hodges ain't coming. We should go."
An impact rocked the car just as the driver's door flew open. Emmy screamed and Carter grunted in surprise as they turned to see what was happening. Mr. Hodges dove into the car, throwing his rifle onto the front seat. He glanced back at them quickly and then grabbed the steering wheel. Emmy heard the car's transmission grind into gear, and the next instant she was thrown forward as the car accelerated in reverse. Mr. Hodges was looking over his shoulder to see out the back window. His eyes were wide with fear, his mouth set in a lockjawed grimace. The right side of his face was covered with blood, and a patch of his gray hair was matted against his head. The car was making a sound like a wind-up toy as it raced down the driveway in reverse. Mr. Hodges hadn't even closed his door yet. Cold, damp air rushed into the car as he drove. After a few moments, he whipped the steering wheel around, which sent the car into a grinding arc as it skimmed over the gravel on the main road. Emmy latched onto Carter's arm again as the car slid to the left, spun nearly all the way around, and stopped. She grabbed the back of the seat in front of her, pulled herself up in order to see over it, and screamed. The girl, standing ghost-like in front of the now motionless car, was bathed in the headlight's illumination. She was wearing SpongeBob pajama bottoms and a loose white top. Her hair was short and dark, and her eyes were fixed intently on Mr. Hodges. Emmy could also see that the left side of her neck was gouged open and that her lower jaw hung slack, pulling her mouth down into a grotesque, dark oval.
"Jenny, that's Jenny Navarro."
She sometimes rode to the river on her bike with some of the other big girls. They would play games with her and Carter every now and then. Catch me if you can, monster tag, freeze tag, red light, green light, and all sorts of other games. Some of the other big girls made wisecracks about Carter's size and even about Emmy's legs, but Jenny always told them to shut up. Jenny was always nice to her. Mr. Hodges was staring back at the girl. Without averting his eyes, he reached over and slammed his door shut. Emmy heard him shift the car into gear again.
"She's hurt real bad,"
Emmy whispered, leaning forward to look at her friend with wide, concerned eyes. Mr. Hodges didn't respond. He was reaching over slowly, his hand fumbling for his rifle, while he continued his weird staring contest with Jenny.
"Please, can we help her? She's my friend. Her name is Jenny."
Still no reply. He brought his rifle into his lap, and then Emmy heard the whine of the car's engine grow louder. Jenny was still standing there, her head tilted to one side as if she were looking at something curiously. Emmy could feel vibration through her seat, as if the car was moving, and yet it wasn't. The engine continued to grow louder, though, and a shrill zree sound arose from outside. Mr. Hodges cursed. The back end of the car started bucking side to side, but for some reason it wouldn't go forward. Two other people, an elderly man and a young woman, were standing outside now. Emmy caught a glimpse of them through Carter's window. They were only about 10 feet away, watching them silently, as if mesmerized by the spectacle of Mr. Hodges' car getting stuck in the mud. Mr. Hodges shifted gears, and the car lurched a few feet backward before stopping again. As if jolted from a trance by the car's movement, Jenny finally moved. Stepping forward, she'd leaped on top of the car's hood, landing with her face pressed against the windshield. Emmy could see red stuff and other dark things flowing from the hole in the side of her throat. Despite her friend's broken jaw and other wounds, her expression was blank. She didn't look like she was in pain. She also didn't look mad, sad, or happy. In fact, Jenny showed no emotion at all. She was just lying still on the hood, her face pressed against the glass, staring at Mr. Hodges.
"God help us,"
he whispered slowly, staring back at her. There was a kind of stalemate for a few moments. And then Emmy saw her friend lift herself up, rear back, and slam her fist against the glass. Cracks immediately webbed out from the point of impact. Emmy hadn't realized that her friend was so strong. She lifted her hand from the windshield, and Emmy saw that it was now covered in blood. She punched the windshield again, and even more cracks appeared in the glass.
"Come on, come on,"
Mr. Hodges growled under his breath. He looked down and was trying to shift the car, judging from the grinding noises Emmy was hearing.
"There,"
he said as the car jerked forward. For just an instant, Jenny's face was pressed against the windshield once again, but then she was gone. Emmy looked back and saw her friend rolling off the side of the road. The other people were in the middle of the road, walking past Jenny, slowly following the car. Emmy could feel her heart pounding in her chest. She was too confused to speak. Her mind was racing from question to question, but she didn't know how to ask them. Carter, too, was upset. He was rocking back and forth on the seat next to her. His hands were clasped to his knees, and he was mumbling to himself.
"Mr. Hodges, I...
Emmy stopped and tried again.
What?
"Child, I do not know,"
Mr. Hodges interrupted.
I just don't know," he said. "I came this way to check on my friend Barty before heading toward your place. Barty's trailer park was a wreck, so I pull in and get out of the car. This guy, I think it was the guy that lives in that big unit on the end, he comes around a corner all of a sudden and knocks me down. He rips open my overalls, claws my leg with his damned bare fingers, and tries..."
He stopped his narrative to glance at Emmy through the rearview mirror.
"I think he tried to take a bite out of my leg, honest to God."
Emmy crinkled up her nose in disgust.
"Well, good old Barty comes up and belts the guy in the side of the head with a 2x, and he rolls off and starts howling out this weird, girly scream. I get up, and before I can even thank him, some big lady, naked as a jaybird, I swear, bowls into Barty and knocks him down. Before I can do anything, she bites his nose off. Off! Barty was screaming bloody murder. I took a running start and knocked that lady off of him, but Barty was rolling around on the ground holding his nose, blood coming out everywhere. I look up, and there are 3 more of these crazies coming toward us. The fellow from the end, the unit, is up again, blood just gushing down his face, but he's walking toward me like he just don't care that he got the side of his head bashed in."
Mr. Hodges reached down and turned on the car's heater. Emmy saw that his leathery hand was shaking badly.
"I get hit from behind with something, I don't know what, and my world starts spinning. Barty calls out for me, tells me not to leave him, and God forgive me, I ran. Jumped in the car and got the hell out of there.
Emmy was listening intently, trying to understand everything that he was saying, but it all sounded so strange. She was scared, but somehow seeing an adult look so upset made her feel worse. Her tummy was tied up in knots, and she felt like she needed to throw up.
But why? Why are they acting like that? Jenny's my friend. She shouldn't be trying to hurt you.
Mr. Hodges shook his head.
Child, I do not know, he repeated.
He slowed the car and pointed to the right.
Hush now. We're passing by the trailer park.
Emmy bit her lip, suddenly worried about all the bad people that Mr. Hodges had just described. She knew the trailer park he was referring to. Jenny lived there, along with some other kids and grown-ups. There were about 7 houses or so, all arranged to form a rough semicircle just off the road. The rain had now slackened to a light, steady drizzle. Fog clung to the ground in patchy blotches, but Emmy could clearly make out the tops of the trailers. She grabbed Carter's arm again as their car came around a bend in the gravel road. Mr. Hodges brought the car to a stop opposite the driveway.
Oh, no, he breathed. Don't look, child. Don't look at them, he moaned.
It was too late. Emmy had already seen them. There were 5 or 6 people standing in a small cluster in the center of the dirt cul-de-sac that formed the little neighborhood's center. They were all facing each other, although none of them seemed to be talking. Emmy noticed they were all swaying gently from side to side. The motion looked very strange and reminded her of church ladies she had seen in the throes of worship on the rare occasions when she'd been taken to church. From the back row, Emmy would watch them sway back and forth to the live organ music and remembered being fascinated by the whole spectacle. But she didn't hear any music now and wondered what unholy melody drove them to move back and forth in identical rhythms as they stared at one another across the invisible circle. Slowly and in perfect unison, they turned to face the car. They were only about 50 feet away, and Emmy could clearly see that they were all very hurt. She saw the naked woman that Mr. Hodges had mentioned. One of her legs was ripped open, and Emmy could see something dark protruding out of it. The faces of 2 of the men in the group were so bloody and mangled that they were almost unidentifiable, although one of them sort of looked like Jenny's dad. There was an older man, too, who reminded her somewhat of Mr. Hodges. His nose was a dark, truncated and bloody circle, and Emmy wondered if he was Mr. Hodges' friend, Barty.
Why did they try to hurt you? Were they mad?
Emmy felt the car begin rolling forward again and noticed the crowd had started walking in their direction. They moved slowly, jerkily, as if they were all very, very tired. Emmy felt the car accelerate, and soon the trailer park was lost to view.
Emmy, I just don't know.
He reached up and wiped some of the blood off the side of his face, glanced at his hand, and swore under his breath.
Those people just went crazy, I guess. Someone's got to make it to town and get the sheriff out here to put a stop to this madness.
Mr. Hodges continued driving for a silent couple of minutes. They passed a few houses here and there, but saw no one else.
The hospital, then Sunderson, Emmy. That's what I'm going to do.
He nodded as if to reassure himself that he'd made the right decision.
That's what your daddy would expect me to do.
Emmy, her forehead crinkled up into a look of confusion, glanced at Carter. He returned her gaze and merely shrugged. Turning back, Emmy asked,
Mr. Hodges, what do you mean, expect me to do?
The man sighed.
If your grandmother didn't tell you nothing, then there's a lot you don't know, Emmy.
He looked back at her in the rearview mirror again.
I'm one of your father's men. Been so for over 2 decades. I hurt my back on a job, and your father... Damn, he's a good man. Most men would have put me out to pasture. Your father? He comes to the hospital and tells me he's got something even more important for me to do. Calls it a secret mission. He puts me up in that little house down the road from the 2 of you. Tells me all bills are paid and tells me to keep an eye on you 2. Let him know every now and then how you're making out and such.
Now Emmy was really confused.
You work for my daddy?
Child, I worked for your granddaddy when your daddy was a schoolboy, he said with a proud smile. When he passed on, I started working for your father. Told him I'd watch out for you 2. And that's what I've been doing. Earned my pay this morning, too, the way I see it.
Well,
was the best Emmy could manage. Her mind was spinning it again. Oddly enough, the idea that she had a father somewhere in the world had never occurred to her. Emmy thought about it for a moment, and one question rose to the forefront of her mind.
So, if I have a daddy, how come he hasn't come to get me from Grandma's house?
Mr. Hodges' smile quickly faded.
That's... He cleared his throat and said, "That's a fair question, Emmy."
Afterward, though, he fell silent. Watching him through the rearview mirror, Emmy saw that he looked decidedly uncomfortable. He had started mumbling to himself again and kept glancing out each of the side windows.
"Sir?"
Mr. Hodges didn't reply. He was slowing the car again, and Emmy realized that they were coming up to another trailer park. This one had an old wooden sign near the road that read, Pecos Bridge Estates. The community was much larger than the first one that they had passed, and even had its own basketball court and a small in-ground swimming pool. The nearby bridge that lent the trailer park its name was a long, single-lane railroad bridge that had been converted for vehicular traffic. Emmy always hated going over it because the rickety old bridge had wooden planks that clacked loudly as cars passed over, and the steel girders that arched above it were orange with rust.
"Don't see no one,"
Mr. Hodges said under his breath. He rolled down his window and slowed the car to get a better view as they passed by the neighborhood's entrance. Emmy was getting that creepy, goosey-bumpy feeling again.
"Maybe they're still asleepin',"
Mr. Hodges grunted quietly.
"Huh, don't know. And don't want to find out."
He accelerated again as he rolled up his window. Finding Emmy's eyes in the rear-view mirror again, he continued,
"Emmy, I don't know if you're old enough to understand this, but your mother, well, she's a wild one. I think that's what attracted Robert to her in the first place. He fell head over heels, that's a fact. But there are some fillies, they're just too wild to tame, child. Robert tried, oh boy, did he. He even took her to the doc, got her some meds for her brain. It worked for a while, and she just spiraled out of control. In the end, she packed you two up and left. She made some threats, too, and that scared the hell out of Robert."
He squinted for a moment as he examined Emmy. Nodding to himself, he continued,
"Emmy, I'll let your father explain the particulars to you. For now, let's just get you there. You're going to love Robert's place, child. He owns quite a bit of land, cattle, horses."
"I love horses,"
Emmy cut in. Mr. Hodges smiled at her, but she saw sadness in his gray eyes.
"I know you do, sweet child. I know. At any rate, your father's pretty well-to-do, Emmy. He'll take good care of you."
Emmy was suddenly excited. Her mind pictured the big white house from her dream. Maybe that was her daddy's house.
"But you never answered my question. How come my daddy never came to get me after Mama, you know, after Mama left?"
"Maybe it's best if he explains all of that to you himself. One thing I know for sure, though, and I want you to understand this, is that Robert loved your mother with everything he had in him. Now, that boy fell head over heels for her, he sure did. In the end, though, it was your mother that broke it off with him."
"How come? Didn't she love him back?"
"She did, yes. I wager that is the very reason she left Robert. Being with her was going to cost him everything."
Emmy was astonished. She had a daddy. Her daddy loved her mama. And Emmy was going to go live with her daddy in his great big house. She closed her eyes and pictured him. He was tall, rugged, with dark hair and a handsome, clean-shaven face. She pictured him kissing Mama, then pulling her into a big hug on the front porch of the White House.
"Oh, shit!"
The car slid to a halt in front of the Pecos Bridge, bringing Emmy back from her daydream.
"What's wrong?"
she asked, pulling herself forward to look over the front seat. There was a car near the far end of the bridge, blocking most of the narrow expanse. Even worse, the back of the car was up in the air. Emmy couldn't see the front, but she saw several of the wooden planks sticking up from the bridge.
"Ah, one of them rocks must have hit the damn bridge and someone drove straight into the hole," Mr. Hodges said. "Damn lucky they didn't end up in the river."
"What are we going to do?"
Emmy asked. Next to her, Carter was shaking his head and mumbling,
"No,
No, no.
Mr. Hodges drove out onto the bridge. Emmy could hear the click-clack, click-clack, click-clack of the wooden planks. She pulled Sam up close to her chest, feeling tense as she gazed ahead at the car.
First, we gotta check and see if anyone's hurt in there, and then see if there's a way around. This is the only road out of this area, so if we can't get the car through, we're gonna have to walk it.
Carter was still mumbling. He was shaking his head back and forth more and more fervently. Mr. Hodges stopped the car about 10 feet behind the other vehicle, grabbed the rifle, and opened his door.
Y'all two stay here. I'll be right back.
He turned and walked, limping on his bad leg, around to the driver's side of the car in front of them. Mr. Hodges had been right. The gaping hole in front of the car looked like it was almost as big as the bridge itself.
No, 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 no,
Carter said, his voice getting louder now. There was a new urgency in his tone.
What's the matter? Why do you keep saying that?
Carter didn't answer, but he stopped his chanting. Slowly, he turned to face Emmy, who stared into his eyes, trying to read them.
Carter, what's wrong?
He turned even more, so that he was looking back toward where they had come from. Emmy watched him and turned to see what he was looking at.
Oh, no,
she whispered. There were at least 10 of them, people she recognized from the trailer park that she had just passed. Some were visibly injured, others weren't. All of them, however, were walking very strangely, as if they were sleepwalking, or perhaps very drunk. Grandma, Emmy remembered, would stumble around the house and sometimes knock things over once she had drunk too much. These people were bumping into one another, lurching sideways, and sometimes nearly falling down. One of the women on the outside of the group stumbled, pitched sideways, and would have fallen off the bridge if there hadn't been a handrail there to stop her. Despite their lack of coordination, though, they were making quick progress over the bridge. Emmy turned around, her heart beating rapidly.
How did you know they were coming?
Carter didn't answer. He had turned around, too, and was watching Mr. Hodges. The old man evidently hadn't noticed the group of people coming up behind them. He was bent over, trying to reach into the driver's window of the stuck car.
No!
Carter explained. He shot his arm forward as he shouted and started waving his hand frantically. Mr. Hodges must have heard Carter's shout. He turned, and Emmy saw his eyes go wide.
Get down!
Emmy ducked, but scooted over so that she could watch Mr. Hodges through the gap between the front seats. She saw him shoulder his rifle and tilt his head over it. He fired, and Emmy flinched at the loud bang. Emmy spun around just in time to see one of the people in the front of the group fall backward, his arms flying up over his head. Emmy was shocked to see absolutely no reaction from the rest of the people, though. They didn't run away, or duck, or even glance down at the man who had just been shot. Several of them actually walked on top of the man. They stepped on him, stumbled, and kept walking.
Bang!
Emmy saw bits of blood and bone explode away from the side of another man's head. He teetered sideways, took 2 more steps, and fell. There was a third shot. And the woman who earlier had bounced off the bridge's handrail fell to her knees, looked up, and screamed. It looked as though the woman was staring right at her, but although her scream was filled with rage, her face was utterly expressionless. The sight sent a new chill down Emmy's spine. The woman pitched forward, but started crawling toward them, dragging the bottom half of her body along the bridge.
Bang! Bang!
Another man dropped, but the group was getting closer now, and Emmy was starting to wonder if Mr. Hodges would be able to stop them all before they reached the car. She twisted in the seat to look his way, and froze. The thing that had crawled out of the car window just behind Mr. Hodges could not be called a person. Not anymore. Its face was almost completely missing, and the flesh of its cheeks and neck had been replaced by thick, oozing mounds of bumpy green scabs. Only a few tufts of hair remained on its scalp. The rest of the skin was missing, exposing patches of smooth red skull. Emmy started to shake uncontrollably. She couldn't move, couldn't even scream. A small part of her could hear Carter yelling, and she recognized a warmth growing between her legs that could only mean that she had peed herself. Just behind the old man, the thing drew itself into a squatting position atop the car's roof. Opened its hideous, broken mouth, and leapt. its bare arms looped over Mr. Hodge's shoulders, causing his rifle to fire up into the air as they fell forward onto the bridge. They landed side by side, and the creature immediately grasped for its prey. The old man turned and grabbed desperately at the thing's neck, just as it tried to bite his face. Emmy felt the car bounce, and turned just in time to see Carter jump out of his door. In an instant, he was gone.
Gone!
And then she was all alone. She screamed, so completely consumed by terror that her mind was numb to all coherent thought. She could hear things, see things, feel things, but they were distant and unreal. A man was screaming. There were other sounds she couldn't identify, and the hot, thick air in the car seemed to thrum with the terrible, unnatural howling from outside. Emmy turned and saw that their attackers were very close now, though several had stopped to stare at Mr. Hodges while they bent forward and howled at him. Time melted into a blurry, slow-motion fog. The sights and sounds surrounding Emmy were excruciatingly real and yet almost intangible at the same time. She felt the familiar spike of ice-cold fear stab her chest. This was her specter, her devil. She was alone. Even Carter had abandoned her. The single crystalline icicle of dread quickly cascaded into an avalanche of unstoppable white fear crashing in on her, pressing her chest, filling her ears with a steady, terrifying buzz. She closed her eyes tightly and screamed as hot tears flowed down her cheeks.
Mama!
She hugged Sam as hard as she could.
Mama!
She screamed again. The car rocked, and Emmy's eyes flew open to see a hideous, half-eaten face peering in at her through Carter's open door. It was an older woman, someone she vaguely recognized. There was a jagged hole in her right cheek that allowed Emmy to clearly see her red teeth, and the flesh below one of her eyes had been torn away to leave a ragged gouge that wept tears of thick, greenish pus. The woman canted her head to the side and locked eyes with Emmy. They were empty, unseeing, dead eyes. They were Grandma's eyes from her nightmare. The woman lunged for her, and Emmy finally moved, shoving herself back along the seat. The hands that clutched for her were bloody. They grabbed at her, caught her dress, and pulled. The material of her dress tore away as Emmy continued backing up, trying to get her immobile legs out of the madwoman's reach. She felt the car door against her back, as hard and unyielding as a prison cell door, and knew she had nowhere else to go. The woman was now inside the car with her, sprawling on the back seat where Carter had been just moments before. Emmy shut her eyes again.
Mama, please! Mommy!
She felt pressure on her ankle. The woman had grabbed it and was squeezing it. Then she was falling backward. The car door vanished, sending her spilling out onto the bridge. She looked up to see Carter's face looming over her, framed by the ancient girders of the bridge above him. He grabbed her, yanked her free from the woman's grasp, and threw her over his shoulder in one fluid motion. Emmy looked back to see the woman holding some of the bandages that had been torn off of her leg. The woman pulled them to her face and began frantically shoving them into her mouth. Emmy's tummy lurched at the ghastly sight, and she looked away. The bad people completely surrounded them now. Carter ran down the bridge, easily pushing one of the men away with his free hand as he went by. They passed the spot where Mr. Hodges had been, but neither he nor the thing that had attacked him were anywhere in sight. Carter took a few more steps, working his way around the hole in the broken planking, before he was forced to stop. Other than a few twisted, narrow metal beams on the side of the bridge, there was nothing left of the expanse. Emmy leaned over and peered down anxiously through the hole. The San Antonio River galloped and leapt briskly in its earthen trough below. At the river bend near Grandma's trailer, where Emmy and Carter often played, the river was wide. Its waters slid by with a soft and contented gurgle. Not so here. The river was angry, anxious. It growled with a low, throaty rumble that frightened Emmy. Carter had turned around to face the bad people. They weren't far, and there was nowhere to run. Her brother seemed to sense it, too. He was holding Emmy with his left arm, so he put his free right hand on top of his head and looked down at his feet. Emmy was filled with frantic dread. She seriously doubted that the bad people would recognize or even care that Carter was trying to show them his sign of submission.
"Carter, no, you can't do that right now."
She looked up. The bad people were coming closer, already passing the front end of the disabled car. Then Emmy noticed that there was a gap between the crowd and the side of the bridge.
Carter! Run, Carter! See, to the right!
She shouted. He didn't look up, but instead started patting the top of his head. He was rocking back and forth, shifting from the balls to the heels of his huge feet, mumbling unintelligibly.
Please, Carter! You gotta run!
She screamed. She started to beat on his shoulder with her fists. The bad people were already closing in, extending their arms toward them. The gap she had seen earlier was nearly gone.
Carter, please!
Cold, seeking hands reached up for her, opening and closing like the mouths of disjointed fish rising out of a sea of crooked, pale anemones. Emmy started to scream as she jerked her arm away from the nearest of them. Carter finally looked up and started pushing their hands away with his free hand. He wasn't running, though, or fighting. He was fending them off, nothing more. One of the bad men grabbed Emmy's wrist, squeezed it painfully, and pulled. Emmy pitched forward, held around the waist by her brother's arm. She looked up just as the man opened his mouth. Emmy's fingers were inches from his face as he wrapped both hands around her wrist. She was screaming, her eyes transfixed on the hideous maw closing in on her fingers, when the dead-eyed man's face seemed to implode. After a split second of confusion, Emmy realized that Carter had punched him with such force that his face simply vanished, replaced by her brother's huge right fist. Blood exploded outward in a red arc as the Batman's legs buckled beneath him, and he fell lifelessly to the deck of the bridge.
No!
Carter shouted down at him. She heard fiery rage in his tone. He looked up at the rest of the bad people and shook a finger at them.
No! No! No!
He yelled. Emmy ducked away from another reaching arm and felt Carter twist his body. He bowled the bad man over with a massive backhand that sent him flying off the bridge. Emmy had never seen her brother hurt anyone before. No one, she supposed, had ever been stupid enough to try to fight him. Now Emmy rode on Carter's shoulder as he charged and raged into the crowd. He was striding forward, bowling into people, knocking them down, grabbing them by their heads, and tossing them into one another. The bad people were still clutching for them, though, and Emmy was swatting their hands away as they reached up for her. They were nearly back to the car at the edge of the hole, but the crowd was following them, hemming them in. Carter would kick one person away, but another would immediately take their place. Still, if he could just get clear, even for a second, he could make a run for it. Then, Carter was falling. Emmy's world spun crazily, and she remembered thinking that no one could make her giant fall. Yet, somehow, he did. And now, Emmy was plummeting through the air. There had been a crash, the sound of shattering wood, and then she was falling, falling, falling. She saw the bridge above her, the wooden beams flying through the air, the bad people twisting as they dropped all around her, still trying to clutch at her. She watched as the car slid the rest of the way into the hole. One of the wheels caught on a beam, which caused the vehicle to flip upside down as it tumbled off the bridge directly above her. Afterward. Can't wait for more? Visit the blog at www.zombiechapters.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.